I'm Richard Rogers from Santa Barbara. I am the Fish and Game Commission's Vice President. Ordinarily, you would be listening to Bob Hatoy, the Commission's President, but Bob is in the hospital right now and cannot join us, and our thoughts are with Bob. Sitting to my left is Commissioner Judd Hanna. And sitting to my right, around this guy right here, is Commissioner Jim Kellogg. This is John Carlson, the Executive Director of the Commission. Bill Cunningham, in red, is the Attorney General. He wears red so that you can tell the lawyer in the room. That's usually what he does. Okay, then over at the opposite table is Sankey Mastrup, who is Deputy Director of the Department. Let me see, who else do we have here? John McCammon, who is Chief Deputy Director. Sherry Cole of our staff, Sean Cubbage of our staff. John Ugaritz of the Department over there. Let's see, who else do we have? Adriana Shea of our staff up here. And who else? Don Cook is in the corner over there. And Neil Manji, are you around here somewhere, Neil? At least you were. There's Neil over there, also of the department. Gary Stacey, there's Gary back over there in the corner. Who else is here? I did call John. Ed Pert was here last night. Is Ed around? There he is, hiding behind the stand there. Let's see. Okay, and then we have wardens Jackie Krug, Paul Weldon, Lieutenant Rick Banco, and Ron Van back in the corner. But I might ask Krug, Weldon, and Banco to step forward slightly, if I may. If you would get yourselves into a position where people could look at you. Here we are over here. These three wardens were the first responders to that very recent mountain lion attack on the North Coast. And their professionalism and quick action, responsive action, resulted in a good resolution to the incident. And you guys are a real tribute to the Department of Fish and Game. Thank you very much. Okay, we're ready to go to our agenda. Yeah. Oh, and Chief Nancy Foley. Why would I forget the chief? Nancy, would you like to give the law enforcement? Later on. That's right. I'm going to do that later on. Okay, so we'll go to our agenda.
Thank you, Commissioner Rogers. We are going to start with item 12 today, which is the receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 5.51 and addition of subsection 7.50B53.8 of Title 14. This is related to Lake Davis sport fishing. Dr. Ed Pert of the department has some introduction on this. And at this point, let me also announce to the public, if you want to speak on any agenda item, you need to pick up a green card on the table in the back and fill it out with the agenda item you want to speak on and bring it over to our staff at the table on the side. At this point, I have no speaker cards for this item 12.
I might emphasize, by the way, Ed, pardon me, before you start. If you're filling out a speaker card on an agenda item, we will tell you when we get there and we look at how many speaker cards we have, how much time we'll be able to allocate, because we have certain wheels up times for aircraft and whatnot today. It's very important that you make your comments on the agenda item that you say you're going to make it on. Like if we're going to be talking about the Marine Life Protection Act on the Central Coast, we want your comments to be specific to that, not anywhere else. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners, Executive Director, and staff. The department is proposing two fishing regulation changes at Lake Davis, and of course, Lake Davis is a location where the non-native invasive species northern pike is present. that is threatening our state's fish and wildlife resources as well as our state's economy. And the first proposal that we have for your consideration is to increase the daily bag limit of trout from 5 fish per day to 10 fish per day, and the possession limit would remain the same at 10 fish. The reason for this is simply that we will be moving forward with an eradication of pike in the fall of this year, and we want to be able to allow anglers to take advantage of that trout resource to the extent they can before the eradication, because all the trout will be killed at that eradication. This proposal will go into effect as soon as is feasible through the regulatory process if you adopt it, and it will continue through September 15th of this year. The second proposal that we have relates to what anglers do with pike if they catch a pike. The current regulation states that anglers need to cut the pike's head off and return those pike to the department. At the time that that regulation was put into effect, there was good reason for it. We needed tissue sample for genetic studies at that time, and we also wanted to monitor what was going on with the population, so we wanted to know all the pike that were caught at Lake Davis. What we're proposing is that we allow anglers to cut the fish's heads off and then just put the fish back into the lake. A lot of pike are being caught, as I think I've mentioned previously to you, and the anglers are telling us that it's actually pretty difficult for them to get those fish to the department staff. And also, once it's to the department, we have to take our time and actually pay for proper disposal of those fish. So it just doesn't make sense to have anglers return those pike to the department at this time. It also gives us the added benefit of it simplifies the enforcement, because it would be illegal for anyone to possess a pike either dead or alive. And so those are the two proposals that you have for your consideration, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
We don't have any speaker cards on this. Any questions from the commission?
Thank you,
Ed. I actually do have one question.
Sure.
Ed, since we are going to be killing all of the trout, and you're proposing a 10 trout limit?
Right.
As we get closer to the event, is there that wonderful possibility that most anglers dream of, no limit possible?
Yeah, actually, we considered that, and we consulted with enforcement, and they didn't like that idea because there has to be a possession limit in those other waters around Lake Davis, and so it would be very difficult for them to discern whether those bag limits and possession limits over 10 would be coming from Lake Davis or not. You'd actually have to tag those fish that came from Lake Davis, and that would be very difficult to do. So we considered that, and we decided that probably wasn't something that was logistically feasible.
Thank you, Ed.
Yeah, thank you.
Moving on to item 13. And this is the second part of this proposal from Dr. Pert. Receipt of public testimony on proposed addition of Section 721, Title 14, related to suspension of flow requirements from Grizzly Valley Dam at Lake Davis.
Right, and I have a very brief PowerPoint presentation that I need to bring up for this presentation. It's the one that says Lake Davis 5937, I think, is in the title. If you don't mind bringing that up, please. Thank you very much. Something just zapped there before it went up onto the screen.
Was that one of those, this is your brain on something?
It worked earlier. There we go. All right, thank you very much. So as I mentioned at your previous meeting, our director approved a pike eradication project on January 23rd this year, and we plan for implementing the pike eradication project in September. That would be after Labor Day and before October 31st of this year. And as part of that implementation of the pike eradication project, there will be a reduction in stream flow below Grizzly Valley Dam in Big Grizzly Creek, and those flows will be cut off for 5 days after rotenone is applied to Lake Davis to allow for thorough mixing of the rotenone in the reservoir. And also as part of the neutralization of rotenone, which will be needed, flows will be reduced potentially as long as cutting the flows off for 45 days. Now, the concern here is Fish and Game Code 5937, which states that the owner of any dam shall allow sufficient water at all times to pass over, around, or through a dam to keep in good condition any fish that may be planted or exist below the dam. And obviously, if we reduce the stream flows, we risk violating 5937. So what we're proposing for your consideration is that the commission temporarily supersede Fish and Game Code 5937 for the using or under Fish and Game Code 219A that allows you to do that for the specific and limited purposes of implementing the project. And this would be short-term in nature and would be necessary for the protection of fish and wildlife of the state. And the reason that we are requesting you to do this and the need for this is that the timing of the project is critical. The window of opportunity for which we can eradicate pike is very narrow. It's about 2 months or a month and a half in the fall. And so there is a real risk of delay from legal challenges from 5937 should that occur. And we experienced legal delays in 1997, and that created some logistical problems then. So we're trying to avoid those legal delays now. And we all know that the threat of pike is increasing at Lake Davis, and so if this were to go to litigation, the issues are very complex, and so probably would be a protracted litigation process, and we would miss our window to eradicate pike. Excuse me. Now, we're requesting that you do this, but we really don't anticipate violating 5937 because there will be some flow in the creek, and I just have a couple slides here for you to look at so that you understand what you're deciding on here. This is the stream with the flows cut off this last fall about 400 yards downstream of the dam. At that point, 400 yards downstream from the dam, there's accretion flows that begin in the creek. So the flows would be cut off for the first 400 yards, and then stream flow would occur after that point. So this is what it looks like in the stream 400 yards below. And this is what a pool looks like just downstream below that. So there is adequate flow to keep the water temperatures adequately low for trout and other fish species, and the oxygen concentrations high enough for those species. So unless there's a real protracted period of dry, hot weather, we don't expect to be violating 5937. However, like I mentioned, just to ensure that we don't have a problem, we would like you to supersede that temporarily for this project. And that's the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Dr. Byrne.
I think we're finished. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you very much.
That moves us to item 14A and 14B. And we have some public speaker cards identified for each of these items. So we'll start with 14A, discussion of proposals for changes in the 2007 to 2010 mammal hunting and trapping regulations. Sankey Mastrip. Deputy Sankey Mastrip.
Good morning, Commissioners. The only thing the department has to add to the original presentation at the last commission meeting about the proposed mammal regulations, there was a request to consider a bear season, adding San Luis Obispo County to the bear season. Because of the stage of the process, the regulatory process we're in, it's not possible to do that this time. But we are working with staff and the regional staff to look at the feasibility and what it would take to add that county to the bear season the next time we do mammal regulation.
Commissioner Kellogg?
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. Yeah, we will put it on the plate for next time. It's just something we weren't aware of.
All right. Thank you, Sankey.
Okay, we have a few speaker cards for this issue, 14A. And please limit your testimony to 3 minutes or less. We'll start with Walt Manzel, followed by Dick Dasman, followed by Rich Maxwell.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the Commission. Walt Manzel, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. Briefly on three items, we will be working with the department on the bear proposal for San Luis Obispo County. We will also be working with a sportsman club in San Luis Obispo County and some other muzzle-loading people on a rewrite of the law to allow the use of muzzle-loading pistols in hunting big game to come up with some kind of workable solution that people in the field can deal with. And we will be coming to you potentially in a year or two for a change in the deer season up in Zone C, Eastern Tehama County, and the G1, the late season in the C zone there. We're working with the unit wildlife manager for the department in that area on a possible extension of a few more days in that season. That's a season that we had a 16-day season for 3 or 4 years, and then a couple, 3 years ago, it was cut down to a 9-day season. We don't know that we can get all of those days back, but we would like to get some of them back, and just a heads up that we're looking at some kind of radical things like perhaps a Wednesday or Thursday opening and some different things that the department people up there are kind of interested in trying also. But at this point in time, we're not going to ask for that until the overall herd compositions in the area look like they are, that would work all right. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
And these comments right now are on 14A. If you want to speak on 14B, please hold off and I'll call your name. Dick Dasman, followed by E.B. Dugan.
Morning. Thank you for visiting with the public again this month. I'm Dick Dasman, Royal Grande sportsman. I'm also representative members of the Santa Maria Sportsman, San Luis Obispo Sportsman, and the Central Coast Chapter of Safari Club International. This morning I wanted to speak briefly on the bear season in San Luis Obispo County. I requested this at the last meeting. Apparently somewhere in the process I misunderstood the procedure. I first notified the commission on this issue back in September via email and was told at that time on the phone that the time to bring it up would be February meeting, which I did. Apparently that's a little late in order to suggest these changes. I understand one of the issues with the bear season is the use of dogs and the possible conflict with the kit fox in the in certain areas of the county. However, we allow pig hunting and quail hunting now with dogs year-round, so I don't believe that that should be an issue. That was the one point on the bear season. I would urge that we've been trying to get this bear season for some time, and I'd hate to let it sit until 2010 to enact it. We do have a lot of bears in the county. The Fish and Game Wildlife biologists in the county agree there are a sustainable amount of bears. We are increasing the amount of bear incidents in the county on a daily basis with all levels of county, state, and city officials. So the sooner we can get this implemented, the better. As far as we're concerned. My second issue briefly is the use of muzzleloader pistols during the muzzleloader seasons for the taking of big game. And now there are manufactured muzzleloader pistols that have the same or greater impact and velocity and ballistics as many of the centerfire pistols that are used during the regular seasons for big game. And I will work with the department and with the California Rifle and Pistol Association to try and determine some minimums and try and get this law passed such that it's an enforceable law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dasman. Sankey, may I ask, we're not suggesting that because of this timing issue that we wouldn't be able to have a bear hunt till 2010, are we?
No, I think the gentleman's referring to your mammal cycle.
I understand that.
If you stuck to a 3-year, in theory, the next cycle.
That.
But you're not obliged to stick to that. It's something, in theory, you could take it up as soon as next year.
Yeah.
But that's your prerogative.
I just, and for whatever reason that the timing didn't work out for you, we didn't hear this problem 3 years ago. So if we can take a look at doing this like inside of that 3-year cycle, we need to do that. And in the meantime, if there's a nuisance bear, you can always get a depredation permit.
And from a reasonable perspective, someone sending an email to us in September does seem like a reasonable time limit for us to have been able to respond to get you into the regulatory cycle. So I'm a little embarrassed about that. I want to make sure that we can affect this because it seems like just exactly the kind of hunting opportunity we want to allow.
Yeah, and the department is working on this now and having staff look at it. It's a matter of doing the environmental assessment.
Understand.
And potential impacts, and so we'll work on that and report back to you.
Any more? Thank you.
Next speaker is Dick Dasman. Oh, I'm sorry, that was Dick Dasman. That is all the cards I have for 14A.
Okay.
14B is discussion of proposals to amend sections 353 and section 475, Title 14, regarding methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. And Deputy Mastrip.
Yeah, Commissioners, good morning again. What you have before you is a commitment to a promise we made back 2 years ago before you in San Diego when this issue of the emergency listing or the emergency action for condors came up last. And that was to come back to you when there was new, significant, meaningful information for you to reconsider the issue. And with that, we brought you back in December, kind of this idea. You supported it. We drafted you the ISOR with some recommendations simply to set the table to allow you to start having an informed discussion, debate about what your options are and the impacts, et cetera. So what you have before you now is our attempt to clarify and provide you the latest facts as we know it, and then hopefully have some dialogue on the costs, benefits, risks of various actions. I have Dale Steele here who will review the highlights of the environmental document we've produced. It's in a draft form now. So this is kind of your first opportunity to really have an ability to query, take testimony, and really start getting into this issue and look at what options you might consider. If you have no other questions, I'll let Dale Steele go ahead and give you a brief overview.
Please go ahead.
Good morning, commissioners, commission staff. Dale Steele, I'm in the wildlife branch. I supervise the game and non-game programs. I do have a brief PowerPoint on this subject. I think it's methods of take. Can pull that up. Right, and that first slide dealt with the last one, which we've already talked about, so that's where I'd like to start. Can I do that? The one you had up before that was right.
Is that a condor?
Methods of take, I think it's down there at the bottom, isn't it? Right, right, that's it. Just want to skip that first slide if I can. Okay. Basanki said we're here to give you an update on the methods of take discussion that we've picked up dealing with lead and condors. And we have an environmental document out, draft environmental document that's out for public review now. And I think you've received it last week. The public's got access to it. It's on the website as noted up there. I would like to emphasize that we're asking for comments back by April 9th. That's the 45-day comment period typical for these documents. And the document deals with Section 353, methods authorized for taking big game, and Section 475, methods of take for non-game birds and mammals. And just real briefly, as Sankey said, we're here because of the discussion 2 years ago. The department was to come back with suggestions on where, if anywhere, we needed to go on this subject, and or come back sooner if we had new information. I think that's a condor calling. And we're here today for both those reasons, basically, and just a reminder of the requirements that we have to protect the condor under the Endangered Species Act. So the proposed action, the objective of it is to reduce the potential indirect risk of lead poisoning to the endangered California condor, specifically from hunting activities. The department considers this very important to the future of hunting in California to prevent hunting activity from being a factor in condor mortality. That's the issue, the question. No condor deaths in California have been factually or directly attributed to big game or non-game hunting, but it is certainly a possibility and a risk under the current regulations. The proposal would modify Section 353 to prohibit the use of lead in centerfire cartridges, muzzle loader balls, and shotgun slugs for the take of big game in areas currently inhabited by the California condor. I'll show you a map of that area in a second. We also have a proposal that would modify Section 475 to prohibit the use of lead in centerfire cartridges, muzzle loader balls, and shotgun slugs for the take of non-game mammals and non-game birds in areas inhabited by the California condor. The proposal does include an incentive program to assist hunters in obtaining non-lead bullets, and that, as it says there, is contingent on finding funding to be able to make that happen. I want to emphasize that these regulation change proposals would not affect or regulate other public uses of lead ammunition, such as target shooting, plinking, animal damage control on private lands. So the proposed recommendation that we have now identifies the areas that you see there in the blue or gray shaded areas, which represent Deer Zone A South and all of Zones D9, D10, D11, and D13. The darker colors you see in there are actual condor data, which I believe you saw at the December meeting, so what we're using. And we settled on those areas for ease and accuracy of being able to delineate the area. We've also described three other alternatives to this proposed project. Alternative one would be no change, which would maintain the existing methods of take, leaving lead ammunition as is and covered in those two sections. Alternative two increases the area of the proposed project to include the areas represented by deer hunt zones D7 and D8 in the Sierras, which represent part of an additional area of historic range for the California condor. To our knowledge, there aren't California condors in those areas now, but there have been in the past. And then alternative three, which would be a statewide proposal, making the same regulatory changes but across the state of California. And I want to mention that alternatives one and two up there would also include the incentive programs that I mentioned earlier, where the department would assist hunters in obtaining, making up the difference in cost and non-lead ammunition, contingent on funding. The summary of impacts and mitigation, the department concludes that the proposed action would not result in any significant negative impacts to the environment. The project would reduce lead in the environment within the areas inhabited by the California condor and may result in positive effects on the environment, although the significance of these effects is unknown, difficult to measure. Areas of controversy and literature review, these are subjects that we've included considerable amount of information in the environmental document on. On pages 12 through 15 in the document, we provide information that we think factually summarizes what we know now, the data that we've received on this issue. And as Sankey said earlier, this is a draft document, and if we've missed data or there's data out there that we're not aware of, this is certainly the opportunity to bring it to us. We've summarized what we know now. So at this point, the controversy is between the effect of lead poisoning on the California condor and the scientific inference that has been made that traditional use of lead bullets used for the hunting of big game and non-game birds and mammals poses an indirect risk to the condor. We know that lead is toxic to the condor, and it's considered a significant problem in their recovery. Condors are also susceptible to numerous other hazards such as power lines and disease. Recent condor deaths have resulted from both those activities. We also know that lead bullet fragments in the carcass of killed game would pose a risk to scavengers such as the condor. Recent research information has shown that lead ammunition isotope ratios have been measured and found to be similar to the isotope ratios found in the blood of condors carrying high levels of lead. So there's a similarity there. Not an exact relationship, but there is correlation there, it appears. Other sources of lead in the environment from non-hunting activity may be a factor in condor lead levels, but those issues are not well studied at this time. In California, there's no scientifically based documentation of condors feeding on hunter-killed carcasses and ingesting lead ammunition fragments from those carcasses and dying from that lead. However, there have been observations and field notes of condors feeding on hunter-killed game. We just haven't made that connection with the other points there. Research has shown that lead ammunition, as I said earlier, has a similar isotope ratio as lead detected in released condors, and that is different than condors that have only been in captivity. The lead isotope ratios in condors that are only kept in captivity is different than what's in the field, so they are picking up lead in the environment. And the inference from that is that hunting could be contributing to high lead levels found in condors. However, again, other lead sources were not tested in this research. So it's not clear at this time that it will be possible to measure the effectiveness of the proposed measures that we've developed. These are difficult studies to conduct, and so we don't know at this time what the results will be in terms of condor health. So the economic and social effects, approximately 25,000 deer hunters in A zone south and 2,000 in D zone, D9 and et cetera, will be required to acquire lead ammunition unless they voluntarily already switched over to that. In addition to that, the 150 to 200 elk hunters are anticipated to be affected by this, and an undetermined number of hunters, probably several thousand, that hunt wild pig, black bear, and non-game birds and mammals in the area that we've outlined. Non-lead bullets are not as readily available as traditional lead bullets, but they are available. Non-lead bullet alternatives are typically more expensive than bullets made of lead, and this would require more planning by hunters to obtain them. The added expense is unlikely to be significant when considering the overall cost of a hunting trip, and again, a rebate exchange program would help offset that cost if it's available. And I think that's everything. Yeah, that's everything I have at this point.
All right, thank you. Public testimony, or Sonke, do you have more?
We have five speaker cards.
We'll do 3 minutes.
3 minutes apiece. As I call your name, please line up behind the podium. Rich Maxwell, followed by Gary Langham, followed by Dick Dasman.
Thank you, Commission. This is kind of new for me. I came over from Shasta
Please
County.
Please state your name for the
okay.
record. I'm sorry.
My name is Richard Maxwell. I represent the Shasta County Sportsmen's Association over in the valley in Shasta County. We have about anywhere from 60 to 80 members. Just depends on the year. Our concerns, the folks over there, were with the banned lead in the Condor area. And just to make it quick, we want to be good stewards with the environment also, but just sitting here listening to this, the science hasn't really proved anything yet as far as if it's the lead bullets that could possibly kill the condors. There is a real expense for our group as far as I reload bullets, and it is a lot more expensive. You know, you're talking about a box of bullets that's anywhere from $60 to $100 versus something that's anywhere from $5 to $10 for just a working guy. That's quite an expense. And we haven't really proved that the lead bullets would really kill something, or the odds on it are to us kind of astronomical. And we're just worried about, it was brought up that the funding from Fish and Game would offset it. I know you folks have trouble right now with funding. There's the other expense of the ammunition. We do shoot bullets that are copper lead combinations, if that could be considered now in high powered rifles. One of the guys that had brought up more condors have been killed by the power lines than they can scientifically say that they've been killed by the lead from the bullets. And one other fella from the club said they might want to discuss cars, because condor eating a roadkill might be killed by a car versus the odds of being hit by or killed by the lead in a bullet. And that's about all we have. Thank you.
I have a question for you, Mr. Maxwell.
Yes.
You said that you guys have been looking at the cost of the bullets, etc.
Mm-hmm. I'm very conscious of that.
Okay. How many boxes of bullets does an individual hunter shoot at a big game in that range?
Well,
in a year.
At big game, you'll go and probably if you're, I sight my gun in and I have three boys. They all hunt. I might shoot 40 rounds.
40 rounds?
To sight the gun in.
No. I'm talking about shooting at an
animal. Well, you have to consider that when you go load. You got to buy those bullets, because when you go shoot the big game, you want them to be the same and shoot the same spot. Or, you know, you're shooting through that gun. So you might buy 100 rounds of bullets, which if you're loading it yourself, that's just buying the bullets. Get fairly expensive without them. You figure the powder and everything else. But if you were to just go right now, They have solids, copper.
I understand that.
A box of bullets.
About a box of bullets.
I know guys that buy three boxes of bullets. Not me, because I'd go sight my gun in. But, I mean, you're talking about some of the
I understand.
$300.
And since you guys have been talking about the numbers, I'm presuming you have this right on the top of your head. How much you therefore forecast off a box of bullets, how much more it would be to shoot lead ammunition or non-lead ammunition vis-a-vis lead ammunition per hunter?
You can't find that in lower caliber bullets. They solids, that's for like big game for Africa. You know, when you're shooting a 460 something, you're going after large.
You can't
game.
Find what? I'm sorry.
You can't find a solid lead bullet, to my knowledge, or a solid copper bullet in a 257 Roberts or a 223, unless you were going to shoot military ammunition.
So
it's not there.
So you haven't done it. Okay, good. Thank you.
Gary Langham, followed by Dick Desmond, followed by Pamela Flick.
Good morning. My name is Gary Langham. I am the Director of Bird Conservation for Audubon, California, and I speak on behalf of Audubon, California's nearly 60,000 members in the state. I just wanted to say that Audubon strongly supports the Commission in considering a ban of lead ammunition in condor country, and Audubon would also ask that the Commission ask Fish and Game to come back with a recommendation for a phased and effective full statewide ban in the future. The condor is a powerful symbol of California's wilderness and a testament to our will to preserve our own heritage. Audubon has a long history with condor conservation, beginning with the first condor study in the 1940s by Carl Coford. We played a key role in the captive breeding program in the 80s, and today working with hunting groups like Tejon Ranch to reach reasonable solutions to protect condors from lead poisoning. As I speak right now, the 70 free-flying condors in California are at risk of dying from lead toxicity. And in listening to the other comments, I'm struck by the fact that no one has mentioned that all the birds that are taken into captivity, which are regularly captured, have lead in their blood. And for some of these birds, it results in very expensive chelation treatment at the Los Angeles Zoo. So, again, I want to say that every bird tested in the last 10 years has had some background level of lead in its blood. The fact that very few birds have died in California and more have died in Arizona is a testament, I think, to the Los Angeles Zoo veterinarians who are on staff to treat the birds. And if they are acutely affected by lead poisoning, this might take 2 or 3 weeks. I also want to point out the level of lead in the blood, and this has been taken over every month, over years, varies. But I think it's compelling evidence that hunting has a strong role because the lead levels in the condors peak during the fall hunting season in California. And I would offer this as a test as to how if this ban were to be implemented, for how we might gauge success, because you would expect that lead level in the fall hunting months would decrease relative to the rest of the year. So that might be an effective way. I also want to say that Audubon supports hunting and recognizes the key role that hunters play in conservation in California. Many of our members and board members are hunters themselves, and we understand that banning lead ammunition requires the cooperation of the hunting community and some sacrifice on their part. Audubon stands ready to work with hunters to make this transition easier. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dick Desmond, followed by Pamela Flick, followed by Walt Manziel.
Dick Desmond, Royal Grande Sportsman, Central Coast Sportsman in general. Since the last meeting, hearing this issue elaborated on, I went back to the Central Coast in hopes of finding that the availability of non-lead bullets was there. All we as sportsmen want to do is go out to the outdoors and enjoy the shooting sports. And I just assumed this whole controversy was over and done with, and I have no problem with going non-lead. However, I did a study on the Central Coast regarding the availability of non-lead ammo. and I've outlined it in my letter to you. None of the stores in San Luis Obispo County at this time carry non-lead bullets, cartridges. They do carry some Barnes non-lead bullets for reloaders, but those are very limited as well. Two stores carried muzzleloader non-lead Barnes bullets, however, only in one caliber. So the availability of non-lead ammunition is definitely not there on the Central Coast, anyway. I contacted Randy Brooks from the Barnes Bullet Company. He developed the non-lead ammunition for performance reasons for a specialized group of hunters that loaded their own rounds. He did not develop it because of the lead toxicity issue. In fact, that wasn't even in the picture in 1985 when it was developed. His business still primarily loads and develops and manufactures non-lead ammunition for performance reasons, and his biggest client right now is the military. He is virtually the only supplier of non-lead bullets to the cartridge companies. He deals strictly with Federal and Black Hills at this time. Winchester, Remington, and the rest of the cartridge companies have no non-lead bullets available, period. I contacted the Weatherby Company, and they have 11 calibers of non-lead, one weight in each caliber. However, those calibers are Weatherby calibers and are only able to be fired in Weatherby rifles, which are on the high end of the scale for the average hunter and represent a very small portion of the hunters in California. I contacted Powerbilt, which is probably the most popular muzzleloader bullet on the market today. They can absolutely not manufacture a non-lead bullet due to the expanding capabilities they need to have that bullet seat in a muzzleloader. So they're going to have to research and develop a whole new line of ammunition to work out. I've included a letter from Bob Nosler. I contacted him, similar results. I want to thank the commission for giving me some updates over the past month since the last meeting. I've received those from the staff, and I appreciate it. As they said, there are no deaths at this time completely attributed to the lead ammunition kills.
Please summarize, Dick.
Okay. And there is a considerable impact economically. To the extent that the impact on muzzleloaders alone is an increase of 74%. And I have figures on the other calibers listed in the Fish and Game study that were inaccurate according to today's figures. So I would suggest that we at least extend the implementation of the non-lead issue to allow the industry to catch up.
We have to stay on our 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you for input.
Pamela Flick, followed by Walt Manziel.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Pamela Flick. I'm with Defenders of Wildlife California Program Office out of Sacramento. We appreciate the department's proposal, the proposed action to limit the availability of lead in Condor Range. Although the department has recommended voluntary efforts to reduce the availability of lead to condors with the proper treatment of gut piles, such as burying them or removing them from the field, while condors continue to be poisoned and some have died in California and also in Arizona. As noted in the proposal, the intensive program to capture and assess the wild condors for lead blood levels and administer chelation treatment as necessary has undoubtedly precluded additional condor deaths. Also, the heavy clean food subsidy provided to California's condors is also likely skewing true impacts and mortality factors. The recovery goals for the species will never be achieved until these efforts are stopped and we don't have to deal with the lead issue anymore. Regarding the availability of non-lead ammunition, I have a list here of products available from 7 manufacturers and 11 online sources. If the commission would like to have this for their information, I'd be happy to provide it to you. I also have a procedural question about the fact that there's no discussion in the proposal about fines, and I'm not sure if that's something that the commission figures out later after the proposal. Okay. At this time, Defenders supports Alternative 2, which is within the current and historic range of the condors. We feel that adopting this alternative would preclude having to revisit this matter should condors expand their range back into their historic territory in Southern Sierra. We still feel that portions of the South Unit A could be further refined to exclude areas where condors are not known to occupy, including the Central Valley, but I'm not sure if that brings up enforcement issues that are not so good. We also would like to, for the final decision, to include assurances that the department will study the appropriateness and need for a statewide phase-out of lead ammunition should the monitoring data from the proposal support such an action. And just to keep in mind that this isn't just an issue about condors, other wildlife, including bald and golden eagles and humans as well, are impacted by the use of lead ammunition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flint. Next.
Walt Manziel.
Walt Manziel, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. Over the past several years, we've heard discussion after discussion before your commission about priorities and work for the department, priorities and work for the enforcement branch of the department. We're kind of curious how large a priority this will have, and we want to bring to your attention the fact that in any game warden's district, he or she is lucky to spend 24 or 30 hours a week in patrol of enforcement in their district. Violators are out there 24/7, I assure you. Probably in California, there are more ungulates harvested illegally than legally in any given year. And I suspect that is very true in this coastal area, since I had a lot of work in that area several years. In that area, you also have to be very careful comparing data from Arizona with historic condor range in California. It is vastly different geographically. Is vastly different in the number of people that live and recreate and work within the area and the closeness those people have to the area where they hunt or shoot. So the violator can leave his house and go violate overnight and be back home by daylight. That's probably not true for most of northern Arizona, which has a very thin human population and a very low number of hunters compared to those that exist in the range of the condor. They also have a very short big game season in Arizona. They don't deal with anything like we're dealing with of wild pigs hunted 365 days a year in about four of those counties very, very much. You also have a problem if you look at the demographics of Monterey, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara counties. You've got thousands and thousands of acres of agricultural changes in land use in the last 20 years, from dry farming grain into vineyards, row crops, things of that nature. I know from practical experience and from direct knowledge that in many cases the farm workers on those tracts are taking care of the wild pig populations, the deer populations that are otherwise considered predators. And I'm sure those people, most of them not even licensed hunters, are not going to be switching to non-lead ammunition under any kind of program you have. As to the availability, it is still very limited. Centerfire rifle ammunition is produced in a few standard calibers. The only company I can find companies using solid copper bullets in 22 centerfires are Black Hills and Corbon. Federal does not load anything in 22 centerfires, and it's not adequate accuracy-wise. It performs terribly in the firearms that are tested in. I would like to say that I think the program, the voluntary program, had a chance to work. I think it should be energized and made much, much larger and greater. This issue should be a major part of hunter education programs throughout the state of California, and I think the department could put that into place without a whole lot of problem. We do not favor a banning of lead bullets. We favor the hunter educational program.
Thank you, Mr. Manziel. That's our last speaker, Kern. Commentary and questions from the commissioners?
Well,
Commissioner Keller.
Chair, I'm going to reserve my comments for on how I feel about this issue for the next meeting, because we'll have a full report from the department on some of the information that we requested. I just want to make it clear to the public that we are going through the process that we're supposed to go through. We've been struggling with this decision for quite some time now, and it's a decision that this commission is going to ultimately make. And I get irritated sometimes when we are going through the process and one particular group doesn't get their way in the middle of it and files a lawsuit trying to intimidate us to do things differently than the typical process that we're charged to go through. It's apparent to me that we definitely need to define the territory that the condor is in. There are people who have a bigger agenda than just that territory that was brought out here earlier today. And there are a lot of issues that we need to consider before we make this decision. And I just want to make it clear that this commissioner is not going to be intimidated by lawsuits or selfish people that don't get their way immediately. So we'll save the rest of my comments till the next meeting.
Well said, Commissioner Kellogg. Commissioner Hanna?
I'm kind of with you on that one, Jim. But what I hear today is just two sides. One side connecting all the dots that lead poisons condors, and another side saying it's not the case. My expectation would be that the department can come back to us with a little more concrete knowledge. A presenter at your February meeting in Monterey, John Moyer, I believe it's chapter 10 of his book, Return of the Condor, absolutely, in my opinion, connects all the dots and indicates to me that we clearly should be erring on the side of caution here.
Commissioner, in all fairness to you, like I said, we've been dealing with this for a few years now. And I hope that at our next meeting, not only the department, but some of the people that have presented evidence, there's no question that the condors do have a certain amount of lead in them. Whether that's the reason they're dying or not is still some question. But we have had photos of dead condors' stomachs opened up where they've got nuts and bolts and screws and everything else in their bellies, and some of that will hopefully be coming out at the meeting where we're making our decision, and you can get a feel for how complicated this issue really is.
Thank you. I plead new kid on the block, and I've got a lot of learning to do. Thank you.
I actually, now it's time for me. I think we all can plead new kid on the block with respect to this issue, because unfortunately the science is not finalized. It is not finished. And Sankey, if I may get your attention just for a second, what I would like to see, if it's not at the next meeting, it certainly has to be at the one following that. Our next meeting is rather full of MLPA. But what I would like to see is some real studies. What we've been hearing is anecdotal stuff. Like it's going to cost me X amount per box or whatever. I want to know what it's going to cost per box. Availability of ammunition, people don't stock ammunition. There's no reason to sell. If you're in business, if somebody's going to come and request copper ammunition or non-lead ammunition, you're going to stock it. The reason the guys don't currently have it is not because it isn't available. It's because there's nobody buying it. Businessmen aren't stupid. Okay, so the availability question is not going to be an issue to me. What is going to be an issue is what bullets are manufactured, in what calibers, and at what weights. What are the time frames from the manufacturers to respond to a demand increase in the state of California? What are actually the costs associated with this vis-a-vis X number of firings vis-a-vis lead bullets? In other words, we need to really go after this rather than hearing anecdotal people throwing bombs back and forth to one another. I want to look at a real analysis. And, Sankey, that takes a couple of meetings from now, fine, but this is far too important for the recovery of the condor for us to do this anecdotally. We need more scientific-based analysis of this.
Okay. And again, commissioners, I try to emphasize, this is the first. We gave you our understanding of what
we understand that. We understand this is a preliminary right. look at it.
So, and exactly, this is exactly what we're looking for, is what other information can we try and assimilate for you to help you wade through all this?
Well, so we realized the connectivity between an actual condor death in the state of California and a lead bullet fragment in a carcass is going to be very difficult, because we don't think scientifically that's been proven as of yet. So get that part, you know, is so I wouldn't dwell and waste a lot of time on that unless there's somebody's got some information that hasn't been put forward. The other part of it is important.
Right. It's hard to get true facts, but I also still want. A year ago, we put together an educational process, and I want to have the department give us a report on.
Well said. That's a good
on
idea.
How that worked. I don't necessarily buy in to the fact just because somebody says there's more lead in the condors during hunting season than off season is for real.
Okay, so what I've heard is you want a more thorough analysis of the ammunition situation and the manufacturer's ability to respond and some costs, like a full layout of that issue. Then a report on the volunteer efforts. We managed, along with the Forest Service, they were collaborators, and the condo recovery folks. Arizona has done something, too, that I'm sure you've heard about. Do you want us to come back and kind of give you an overview of their program? They went to the ammunition giveaway.
Actually, that would be a good idea if you think it's relevant.
It might be, it, to give the full flavor. Whether California can do that way is in question still, but we'll look at what legally our options are for that kind of program.
Also, Sankey, given the fact that we have an option 3 sitting up there as well, one of the things that I would like to see, you're aware of the Chicago Sun-Times article a couple of months ago on Dove and lead pellets from shotguns and the devastation that was doing to the local Dove population. Those are the kinds of things we need to understand, because this, what we have in front of us, the eyesore, includes not just condors, but the potential impact of lead in the environment. I mean, I'm a waterfowl hunter, and I simply have learned to shoot with steel. Now, granted, I can't shoot a shotgun that won't take that anymore, but that's kind of the way it is. I don't have a problem with that. But what I want us to understand is the other elements of this in addition to just big game shooting.
But we got to be cautious of helping our decision be based on somebody's opinion in some article, too.
Oh, right? I agree. I mean, no, I'm talking scientifically.
Yeah.
Which actually speaks to something Commissioner Kellogg said, the question of whether or not lead levels go up during the hunting season. I'd like to see that study. I'd like to see if it's a scientific study, if it's peer-reviewed.
Those of you around, Mr. Ron Jurek, who's now retired from the department, gave you a rather extensive presentation. It was over an hour long. That was a very thorough review. Would you want us to package that in a document? Because there is really not a whole lot of new stuff. So what we can do is resubmit it in a way maybe that you can digest all of that.
I'm trying to figure out how to help you. Maybe with like an executive summary, because we don't want a whole bunch of disparate things. We want it interrelated. This is so important, not only to the condor and the environment in California all the way across the board from one border to the other, but it's really important to the hunting community. And you've got a lot of people who have a culture of doing certain things, and every time that somebody comes in and wants to change something, either it can be perceived as a threat against hunting per se, which I would really object to if I ever sniffed that one out, but it's just resistance to change. We can't be doing this without some real solid reasons behind it. And sure. I'd like to see those.
Given the timing of the next commission meeting and the time it's likely, we probably won't be able to give you this report until the May meeting.
Well, that was my conjecture.
Okay. In May, April's too quick.
How about my other commissioners? How do you feel about May?
As long as we get it done.
May is fine.
It takes.
Okay, then please, May. Are you comfortable with May, Sankey?
Yes, I think I'll consult with my sweating staff. I think May to compile and do an executive kind of summary on the scientific literature and background by May, I think, is a reasonable thing. If it's not, I'll report back to the executive director
Thank
promptly.
Thank you, and please do. Also, would you also include, if I may, add one additional thing, looking at Nancy standing right behind you, there is an enforcement issue here of some
Huge.
Substance, and Walt brought it up, and we need that to be discussed as well. Nancy, you want to make a few comments?
Commissioner Nancy Foley, Law Enforcement Division. It's not only about a staffing issue, but it's also we currently don't have any means to tell if the rounds are lead-free or not. And so as the science evolves and the regulations evolve, so will the role of the game warden in those condor areas.
Yeah, the magnet on a shotgun shell doesn't work anymore.
No, it's not going to work, and they've developed something for shotgun shells, you know, with it's called a hot shot, but somebody's going to have to come up with something so that we can tell if these rounds are lead-free in the field. And it will impact enforcement. Every new regulation impacts enforcement, so we do have to consider that.
And that would be part of the analysis, please, Sankey.
Yes,
okay?
I will
you.
Burden Nancy with that part of it.
Commissioner Hanna has a comment.
I believe for the most part, hunters are sportsmen, and if a law is passed, they'll follow it. I think it's the rare exception that hunters don't. Enforcement would not be a reason for me not to vote for it.
You're right. 90% of the people are going to comply with the regulations. We spend most of our time on the 10% that don't.
Yeah, and those jerks are ignoring everything anyway. So
you're not going to win that one.
Yeah.
Two things I'd like to clarify. One, that item 14B, discussion of these proposals, will still be on the agenda in April for public comment. And then we just received a late speaker card request for this item.
Given the importance of this, we'll allow that.
David Dempsey, please run up since you're late. You know.
He's not running. He is now.
God, what a great cardiovascular workout, courtesy of the commission. Dave Dempsey with Tauscher Independent, working with a number of fisheries groups. I'll make this really short and sweet. I sat through two presentations on the lead poisoning. The evidence is overwhelming as far as lead poisoning, no question. We had the x-rays that showed the bullet fragments, et cetera, et cetera. I would challenge hunting groups to identify other sources of lead. End of conversation.
That'll actually be part of, I think, what Sankey's going to be. Thank you, Mr. Dempsey. That'll be what we're looking at, is not only the connectivity between the lead ammunition and what's going on in the condor, but also what are the other sources of lead out there. I mean, anyway, okay. Enough said. Move forward.
Moving on to item 15. Department request for commission consideration and possible adoption of emergency action to amend section B91.1 of section 7.50 title 14. This is regarding the Klamath River sport fishing regulations. My understanding is senior biologist Larry Hansen will be speaking on this. Is that true, Larry?
Vice President Rogers, Mr. Carlson, commissioners, good morning. My name is Larry Hansen. I'm a senior biologist supervisor with the department's northern region out of Redding, California. I'm here today basically to talk to you, sort of review what I discussed in Monterey in early February regarding spring run stocks and the need for this emergency regulatory action. We need to protect these stocks basically due to an oversight on our part. I'll be straightforward about that. What happened essentially was, in the 2006 supplementary regulation, there was an ending date added on to the regulations restricting take of these stocks on sections of the Klamath and Trinity River. These sections of the river were from Iron Gate Hatchery down to the Wichipec Bridge on the Klamath River, and from the confluence of the Trinity River up to the mouth of the confluence of the South Fork Trinity River. I'd like you to note that these restrictions on harvest have been in place for several years. This is nothing new. This is strictly trying to clean up language that we did have an oversight on. Population levels for these stocks are very low,
and they've been restricted, as I've said, for several years. These stocks are largely limited to two sub-basins within the Klamath River. That would be the upper South Fork Trinity River above the Hiampaum Valley and the Salmon River in the mid-Klamath Basin. Historically, in 1964, the runs in the South Fork Trinity River were enumerated at in excess of 11,600 fish. The long year, 27-year average that we've had from snorkel surveys in the basin indicate that these numbers are down with an average of roughly 300 fish. In the Salmon River, a 20-year average is essentially around 544 individuals. In 2005, they counted 81 adult spring Chinook in the Salmon River. I'd like you to note that by enacting these closures, we're not going to be restricting fishing opportunities significantly on these sections of river. You'll still be allowed to angle for the other salmonid species that are in these reaches of rivers at that time. And also, catch and release fishing on the spring stocks themselves will be permitted. In the future, God willing, I won't omit these things, the ending dates on these closures will be crafted annually. And that would be allow for fishing opportunity on fall run stocks. So we will do this on an annual basis within the supplemental framework that we have in place. So when in-river allocations for fall run Chinook salmon are permitted, we'll be able to craft these ending dates to allow that harvest to occur. So essentially, like I said, this was all basically a review of what we talked about in early February, and that's all I have for you unless you have further questions.
Thank you. We have some speaker cards in this?
Yes, we have two speaker cards on item 15. E.B. Dugan. This is 15. Change your mind? You want 6? Okay. Do you want item 16 then?
I would like to defer to 16. Please.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then Jim Martin. Okay, that was easy.
We need a motion, don't we? No.
Yes, we do. This item is a...
Any discussion first from the commissioners? Do I hear a motion?
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that we enact the emergency legislation that's recommended in the book.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. So moved. Off we go. 16.
Item 16, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to subsection 7.50B91.1 of Title 14 regarding Klamath Trinity River salmon regulations and selection of an in-river fall Chinook salmon allocation by the commission. We have a couple speaker cards. I'm sorry. First, we have Neil Manji from the department giving a presentation.
Excuse me?
Does anyone have a Chico State shirt for him to be wearing?
And actually, Sunky Mastrip has a...
UC Davis shirt, better yet.
Yeah, I would like to, for the record, this is a demonstration of the challenges we have to work with. As a UC Davis graduate, one of my big challenges is constantly working with these Humboldt graduates and getting them to behave and function properly. So this is a work in progress. So
you mean English as a second language is a problem?
Hold on. This is lumberjack country now.
Yeah, you understand where you are, Deputy Director Mastrip?
Exactly.
We cannot provide security for you to get out of here, okay?
Now, the lumberjack has nothing to do with I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay from Monty Python, does it?
I think the executive director needs to get this under control since he's a Humboldt grad also.
Okay. Go ahead, Neil.
Okay, thank you very much. Neil Manji, Fish and Game, Humboldt grad.
Really?
I have a presentation today talking about the Klamath allocations and the projections for this year. Thank you, Steve. As you recall, in our February meeting, we provided a presentation regarding the Klamath Fall Chinook allocations. This is just the second part in the process as we go forward. Exactly. Okay, here we go. It's the mouth of the Klamath River. Today I will be discussing the review of the allocation strategies, Klamath River run size estimates for 2006, the ocean 2007 ocean abundance, which equates to what the in-river and utilization of the fish would be this year and for fall Chinook, preliminary allocations, and department recommendations. As you are aware, in Monterey, we painted a fairly bleak picture that this year's projections would be very low. I'm here to bring good news that things are looking much better than we had anticipated. We ended with this slide last in early February. DFG's current allocation strategy was to focus allocations to ocean fisheries to maximize value and opportunity for the limited fall Klamath Fall Chinooks. But any surplus fish that cannot be utilized in the ocean would then be turned over to in-river fisheries respond or escapement. We are continuing with that philosophy. Once again, this is just a quick schematic of the Klamath Basin and the major tributaries here. This year's run size for the Klamath in 2006 was 88,000 fish. As you can see, that is the far right bar graph. The average is the dotted line in the middle at 121, so we were about 40,000 below the average. The one thing to note is the grills or the jacks that are denoted in yellow on those bars had a fairly good yellow or jack run this year compared to 05, where you could barely see any of the yellow in that bar graph there. Here's the natural spawner numbers. We have in 06 we had 30,000 adult spawners. As you can see, though, the past 3 years we did go below the spawner floor of 35,000, but as you can see, in other years we have been below the floor also. The significance of that will be the Pacific Fisheries Management Council will require a overfishing review to determine what has occurred to create these lower numbers. The 2006 postseason results from the adult escapements and the counting on the Klamath, once again I said 30,400 adults. It was projected preseason that only 21,100 would come back with the fishing that occurred in 06, so we were a little bit above that, which is a good thing. Age 4 harvest was at 11%. This is also Klamath Fall Chinook. It was predicted to be at 11%, so it came out exactly based on what we had predicted. Please keep that in mind. That is going to be very important in terms of age 4 harvest this year. And then the ocean fall harvest for the credit card fishery was at 920 fish. For reference, in 05, it was a little over 6,000. That gave us the starting kind of in the hole for the 06 fishery. The 2007 projections based on derived from the 06 Klamath numbers. So once again, the key here is that the in-river run for Klamath fisheries is the primary data to project what is going to be back the previous year or made available in the ocean. Like I said, last year the age 2, the jacks came back in large numbers, 27,073. That equates to swimming around in the ocean right now 515,000 fish, which is the largest predicted from 85 to 85 to 06. The age 3, the reason we were in that mess in 05 and 06 was very, very low. We had 18,000, 18,500 come back. And so those age 4 components will be about 26,000 fish in the ocean, which is the lowest on record since 85 through 06. Age 4 returns last year was about 41,000, which will predict about age five returns of a little over about 4,700 fish. So as you can see, the lion's share of most fisheries in a given year is age three and age four. Once again, I mentioned that we have some constraints in the ocean. The slide's a little bit hard to see, but we have Klamath Falls Chinook. We have a spawner reduction rate of 67%, which would not be an issue, which just basically means any particular rate can't exceed 67% of a particular year class. What has been mostly limiting in the past has been the floor, 35,000 adults. The bottom figure there, the California coastal Chinook, is listed as threatened, and as now we do not have a lot of monitoring going on along the coast in terms of adult escapement numbers. So the issue and the opinion states that we will use Klamath age 4 harvest rate as a surrogate. And so anytime Klamath age 4 fish gets caught, that is the surrogate to determine whether we're having impacts on the other coastal Chinook. And that's capped at 16%. Oh, this is even worse. Sorry about that, guys. Really, what I wanted to show on this particular slide is that from 1997 through 2006, on the far left-hand side there, you can see barely see the numbers of preseason ocean abundance, and it ranges from 97 and 286,000 down to 2007 at 530-some thousand ocean abundance. The key here is over those last 10 years, the second column to the right, you see river allocation at 15%, and then it jumps up to like 40, 41, and 26%. Those were all due to constraints in the ocean, those 40s were for Oregon natural coho constraints. The 26% was more of a age 4 constraint. So as you can see, this year we have approximately, in the red down there, approximately 40,000 non-tribal harvestable surplus fish that can be allocated, which will still allow 35,000-plus natural spawners to spawn in the Klamath. It should be noted that no significant commercial fisheries during these last 10 years occurred in the KMZ during any of these years. Due to conservation strategies. It's kind of a where do you want to spend your fish, and it's very expensive. As I mentioned in February at Monterey, the cost of those fish and off the KMG, off the Klamath Coast here. The department's recommendation will be to optimize ocean fisheries value and opportunity under current conservation constraints. Fish that can't be utilized in the ocean should be allocated to the in-river fisheries. Based on preliminary model runs, the in-river allocation would be 6,000 to 10,000 fish this year. Once again, the important meetings for the commission to recognize, we are right there, March 2nd. What the commission adopts today in terms of an allocation or a statement then will be relayed on to the Pacific Council through the department's representative, Maria Vojkovic, and possibly through the Fish and Game Commission's either executive director or staff to confirm or reassure the Pacific Council what the commission has identified. The PFMC meetings begin next week, and then we have options that will be made available based on that meeting for the ocean fisheries, and then there will be one meeting later on in March that will be open for public comment, and then the adoption of the Pacific Council's recommendations to NOAA fisheries will be April 2nd through the 5th or 6th, and then the commission will come back in their meeting on the 13th. Based on noticing requirements, we'll probably have to push that back to teleconference on the 25th. So, in summary, the the in-river fisheries, the fisheries appears to be doing much better this year. We had a strong year. Class H3 is going to carry us this year. We need to, we asked the commission to adopt some type of a resolution that allows the Pacific Council to move forward. And that resolution, in the department's mind, should be that by optimizing ocean fisheries, it does not necessarily include a significant new fisheries in new areas, but understanding that there is an H4 constraint this year, that the river will be getting anywhere from 15% to 27% this year, and rather than a certain percentage, I think a statement such as that fish that cannot be utilized in the ocean be rolled over to the in river will be sufficient to maintain a full fishery in the river in terms of opportunities from when the fish first enter the Klamath Falls Chinook until they spawn. I don't anticipate that there would need to be any closures on the Klamath River this year based on these numbers.
That is really good news, Neil. Makes you think that 2008 might be really good given the trajectory.
Yes, and that we're hopeful of that also, and that's why we made a statement here also today to make sure that the commission does realize that in certain years there may not be ocean constraints, and we'd like to include to make sure that all user groups get, you know, their fair and equitable share.
Now, presuming the federal government can stay smart about irrigation allocations, we may not have to fight this problem again. Okay, we have Speaker Kearns.
Yes, we have four cards. You said
2 minutes.
2 minutes per person. Jim Martin, followed by E.B.
One
Duke.
Minute. Sorry. 2 minutes.
Clock starts ticking. Followed by E.B. Dugan, followed by Rich Maxwell, and then David Bitts.
Not on, huh? How's that? Jim Martin, Recreational Fishing Alliance. I just wanted to speak in favor of the department's recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. 10 seconds. Who's next?
E.B. Dugan plus Rich Maxwell, David Bitts.
Everyone else, please get ready to speak. Line up. We have a very full agenda today.
Welcome to Humboldt County, Commissioners, and especially you, Mr. Hanna, as a new man on the block. Thank you for coming here and hearing us. My name is E.B. Dugan. I represent the Trinity River Fisheries Group. I'm also in-river sport fishing. I'm a member of the Trinity Restoration Program and a committee member of the working group for that subcommittee, appointed by the Secretary of Interior. I thank you for coming here and listening to us. Last year, the in-river group fisheries were left out of the equation. We received a tremendous economic hit, both up and down the river. And this accounted for many of the small businesses in the small communities that depend on these fishermen to come in and spend their money, really, really hurt us to the point that some of those are actually now considering leaving the area. The first cover letter you have there is the one from Willow Creek Community Services District, which is one of the small communities that is enhanced by these fishing people coming in. The second one that you see is typed out. That's from the minutes and so forth that we attended at the salmon hearing Wednesday night. I'm sorry about the handwritten part, but we do live in a rural area. We have a lot of electrical outages, and my computer and typewriter just don't work without, my computer and printer don't work without electricity. One of the things that we have, and this proposal for 2007 goes right along with what Neil has just presented to you. Our findings show that we're looking at the possibility.
E.B., you do need to summarize. We're on a very tight schedule. We'll have to hold to it.
My handwritten, when it is important that you people do notify us, or notify the Pacific Fisheries Management Council of our predicament and do give some kind of written and oral communication to them that you do intend to allocate an in-river fisheries this year. It is important to us.
Yeah, we understand that. Thank you. Rich Maxwell.
Rich Maxwell again for the Shasta County Sportsmen's Association. Mine is very quick. I hope this is the right time. Mine has to do with the catch and release on the upper tributaries of a lot of these creeks. This would be statewide. If we could have something where you guys could consider keeping some of the fish, not the steelhead or the salmon, but the brown trout and the brook trout that you're trying to get rid of anyway in some of these areas, because they're way up. I have a buddy that fixed it, at some kind of clarification anyway, Fox Creek up towards Callahan, that direction, he can't find anybody that can tell him whether he can keep those fish or not. And they're brookies and browns identification. I have the same problem over in the valley on Mill Creek, where I used to, when as a boy, that's the first place I caught a fish. And there's brook trout and brown trout, but you can't keep those fish because it's a rehabilitation for salmon.
Neil, is there any commentary we can make about that specific point?
That was an issue when we had some regulations promulgated years ago in terms of trying to keep the anglers from taking anadromous fish in these tributaries. We have identified a sheet within the region that has probably 100 or over that list of tributaries in the areas that are above anadromous that anglers can get from the department's region.
How can people like Mr. Maxwell access that list, for
example? You could go to just contact the regional office in Reading, and we could ship them a copy of that. And it's or the district biologist in the area. It's fairly extensive. We've been adding to it because there's barriers everywhere.
Thank you. Yep, please.
I've grown up in Reading, and I've fished Battle Creek and Mill Creek and all those, you know, Martin Creek and all the creeks around Lassen. And there is a catch and release on Mill Creek specifically, and it has just killed mineral. You can't even buy a license there. And when I was a boy, that was what you went to mineral for. It was to fish. But you have to go to Chester to get a fishing license now, or Red Bluff. And it's just killed the town. Now they bicycle. Nobody fishes.
Hmm. Thank you. Please, Commissioner Hamm.
I'm from Mill Creek, and I understand the problem there. I think there are a lot of other factors you're not looking at when you make that blanket statement. I'd be happy to go into it with you after the meeting.
Yeah.
However, I think the department has enough information to tell you that in a catch-and-release area, and I'm going to use Fall River as an example, the economic base improved substantially after catch-and-release. But bear that in mind.
Okay.
David Bitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Dave Bitts. I'm a salmon fisherman based in Eureka, a commercial salmon fisherman, that is, which means I travel to San Francisco and beyond in order to fish for salmon. Like you, I'm very happy to see the much better forecast for this year. I'm very happy to see that, that's not correct. I'm not happy to see that we're not going to be able to access our full share in the ocean, because I'd really like to, but given that we have that coastal fall cap, I think the department is on exactly the right track here. Some of our Klamath fish will be rolled into the in-river sport fishery. And with any luck at all, they should have a good season this year. And I was very heartened to hear what you said, Mr. Rogers, about maybe we can get the irrigation policy straightened out and keep this ball rolling. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pitts. Any more speaker cards? Commissioner.
Commissioners, I have a motion I'd like to make if you're ready to entertain it.
Please do.
Rather than make a motion for an allocation of a percentage, I'd like to make a motion that all surplus fish not utilized by the ocean be allocated to the in-river fishery this year.
Do I see a second?
Again, I'm going to claim new kid on the block, and I didn't understand the motion.
Say it again.
You might normally we might just allocate a certain percentage of the fish not utilized by the ocean to the Inland River. My motion is that we allocate all fish that's not utilized by the ocean to the Inland River fishery.
Okay, I'll second that.
Our recommendation this
year. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion's passed. Number, where are we? 17.
Item 17, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 27.80, Title 14, regarding ocean salmon fishing regulations. Is Maria...
Maria going to do this? I see her walking behind the glass.
There she is. Maria Vojkovic from... Department's Marine Region.
Good morning, Commission. Thank you very much. Maria Vojkovic with the Marine Region. Right at this stage of the process, the Council will be meeting next week to develop the range of alternatives and then put those out for public comment. So the packet that we submitted to the Commission is very generic at this point and will be more detailed after the Council meeting.
Thank you, Maria. We have one speaker card.
Jim Martin.
3 seconds. 0 seconds.
Okay. Any discussion by commissioners?
Any discussion? No.
Moving on to item 18.
18.
Receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 632, Title 14, regarding Central Coast Marine Protected Areas. John Ugritz of the Marine Region, Department's Marine Region, will give you a presentation.
Thank you, Commissioners. John Ugritz with the Department's Marine Region. I'm just going to very briefly review the item before you, and then after you hear public testimony, if you have some follow-up or want some specific slide information, I can provide that to you. Thank you. You're looking at three alternatives at this point for marine protected areas in the Central California coast between Pigeon Point in San Mateo County and Point Conception in Santa Barbara County. Your preferred alternative includes 29 marine protected areas, 15 of which are no-take areas, which is about 204 square miles in marine protected area and 99 square miles in no-take MPA, which is 8.6% of the study region, that area between Pigeon Point and Point Conception in no-take MPA. You do also have two alternative to the preferred alternatives. The first alternative, alternative one, includes 29 marine protected areas, 16 of which are no-take areas. This is about 171 square miles in marine protected area and 60 square miles in no-take area, which represents about 5.2% of the coastal region in no-take marine protected areas. And your second alternative to the preferred includes 30 marine protected areas, 21 of which are no-take. This represents 221 square miles in marine protected area, about 148 square miles in no-take area, and nearly 13% of the region in no-take MPAs. And just comparing that graphically, what you see is the existing status quo or the no-action alternative on the left is package zero, which is about 3.75% total area and a very small percentage, less than 1% in no-take area. Package one or alternative one is about 15% total area and about a little over 5% in no-take area. Alternative two, which was package 2R in the Blue Ribbon Task Force process, is nearly 20% total area and about 13% in no-take area. And then the commission preferred alternative, about 18% total area and about 8.5% in no-take area. There are some sub-options in your preferred alternative that I want to bring to your attention so you know what you're considering and where your decisions will lie in April for the preferred. First, at Año Nuevo State Marine Reserve, you need to determine whether or not to allow kelp. And if you do allow kelp, if you do not allow kelp in this area, you would have to alter an existing commercial lease to a leased kelp bed. At Soquel Canyon and Portuguese Ledge State Marine Conservation Areas, you need to determine whether or not you want to allow the commercial take of spot prawn in addition to the allowance of surface finfish in those areas. At the Edward F. Ricketts State Marine Conservation Area, you need to determine whether to allow or prohibit recreational fishing. And if you do prohibit recreational fishing, as we discussed at your last meeting, whether or not to allow anglers with disabilities to fish, remembering that the department's recommendation here is not to provide a special allowance for any class that may put you in a tricky situation with conflict there. And at the Cambria State Marine Conservation Area and State Marine Reserve, you need to choose a boundary option and decide whether or not to allow kelp. As you heard yesterday, there is an existing kelp lease in this area. That lease expires at the end of March. If you want to renew that lease prior to its expiration, you must have a special hearing. You must notice that meeting very quickly and make a decision about what to do with the lease before March 31st. Your other alternative here would be to let the lease expire and renegotiate a lease in April. That presents some difficulties for the current lease holder, which you heard about yesterday. But it also allows you to make your determination about a marine protected area in that area and then how to address the lease. So you have some decisions there. Biologically, the department's position on this is that in the major part of that lease, there's no problem with allowing the lease there. The kelp harvest has been sustainable over many years. Within the area that's potentially a marine protected area, you may want to consider whether to allow harvest with some limitations, as is currently an option in your preferred. To graphically describe those boundary alternatives at Cambria, just so you see, there's sort of two combinations of a park where recreational fishing is allowed and a reserve where no-take is allowed, and you have a northern and southern option for the boundaries of the park and the reserve. And at the detailed level, hope I don't blind anybody here, but your option is essentially the southern edge of the town of Cambria or the northern edge of the town of Cambria, and there's some issues there with whether or not there's access for recreation in the non-reserve portion. These are just some of the locations that you've probably heard about. Lambton Cliffs Park would be that southerly access point that you could fish to the north of it if you draw the boundary there, and you couldn't if you draw the boundary further north. And then finally, you need to consider between now and April whether or not the commission wishes to recommend any minor boundary adjustments within the noticed range of alternatives, and make a determination of that when you decide in April. And with that, that's all I have, and I'm sure you may have questions after testimony or now if you'd like.
John, I'm assuming that the if the commission comes up with any minor adjustments that are within the noticed, that we would want to do that today, and we would probably do that after public comment.
I would assume that would be the best way to do it for the
Thank
legal
you.
Process, yes.
Okay. Any further commentary from the department? How many speaker cards do we have?
17.
17. 2 minutes. 18, 19, 21. Still 2 minutes.
We'll start. Please line up behind the podium when your name is called. 2 minutes per person, starting with Tom Raftikin, followed by Diane Beck, followed by Dennis Mayo.
He's coming. I can see him. Tom's getting older. He's a little slow.
He's down to 31 seconds now.
Steve was chasing me out of my seat anyhow, so it's a good thing. My name is Tom Raftikin, President of United Anglers of Southern California. And in truth, recreational anglers really aren't very good at what we do. And unless there are a lot of fish out there, we're not going to be successful. So we endorse a very strong conservation approach, including marine protected areas in particular, ones that embrace good fisheries management. We do, however, suggest that there are ways to fine-tune marine protected areas that really bring the best out in marine conservation, but also include things like recreational angler safety. While we're not very good at what we do as far as fishing goes, recreational anglers generally have smaller boats and need to fish closer to the harbors. There are many ways to fine-tune marine protected areas, and I think Coastside Fishing Club has put forward some very good examples of that, Point Bouchon, Año Nuevo. And utilizing those small fine-tuning changes allows you to have a high safety value for recreational anglers. And at the same time, by doing that, you dramatically improve the socioeconomic outlook. And we just would ask you to take those things into consideration when you start putting these lines in concrete. Thank you.
Diane Beck, followed by Dennis Mayo, followed by Sue Leskew.
Good morning. My words here on behalf of the Redwood Chapter Sierra Club. The Redwood Chapter has around 11,000 members and includes the Northern California coast from Sonoma County to the Oregon border. In general, we strongly support a comprehensive and carefully designed system of marine protected areas along the entire California coast. It is the best way to restore and protect fish habitats and populations and to reverse the damage and depletion of ocean ecosystems. In particular, for the California Central Coast, we urge you to adopt the preferred alternative, which includes 29 protected marine protected areas, 8 of which are fully protected marine reserves. The proposed protected areas reflect the compromises of many stakeholders, and we urge you not to weaken further those decisions. Please give these 29 reserves and conservation areas time to work. I live near Humboldt Bay and know that our fishermen are already hurting, but many species of rockfish, for instance, have populations that have declined to 10% their historical numbers. Ocean ecosystems and fish populations simply must be protected and allowed to recover. As with the dismantling of 4 dams on the Klamath River, carefully designed ocean reserves and conservation areas hold real promise for future generations of fish and fishermen and the communities that depend on them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bang.
Thank you, Dennis Mayo, followed by Sue Leskio, followed by Mel McKinney.
Thank you, Commissioners. Dennis Mayo from McKinleyville. First want to tell you that this was told to all the fishermen that called in and all the fishermen who are still out pulling crab pots or actually getting done, that this wouldn't be heard until 11 o'clock. And that was sold over. Well, guys, it's a big deal. It is a big deal because there's probably 50 fishermen that want to be here. And so I want you to know
I don't know how you got that word, but this commission never says a time certain.
Well,
I don't wish to argue with you. It is our policy to never say a time certain for exactly this reason. Please go ahead with your comments.
I appreciate that, but I want to just make that comment. Secondly, I just need to say that that's an absolute fallacy that Ms. Beck quoted, 10 reduction of 10% fish stock in our North Coast area. That's absolutely ludicrous. We've got the healthiest nearshore fishery that there is, and our fishermen are absolutely the best that there is. Let me get to my comments. Well, you see what Humboldt County weather is like. This is mostly common fishing weather for us. Even when it's nice weather to most of you, we're in the fog and the tides and the rough rock areas that nobody can get to. Our North Coast region is, in fact, a major marine life protection area already. If you really want to accomplish something to help us when you get up here, let's talk about protecting us out to 12 miles. Many of our fishermen today are out pulling pots, or were pulling pots earlier this morning, and as these continuing protection areas, continuing restrictions get forced upon them, many of them are beginning to think that they need to be growing pot instead of pulling pot to make an economy for themselves. Am I done?
Yes, you are.
We couldn't object more to the process. It's a process driven. We put in some written comments. The Central Coast, you've just hammered them. You obviously didn't look at the economic studies. We followed those economic studies.
You need to be
Thank you.
Be done. Thank you. And may I reiterate something that I said earlier also for everyone? No disrespect to you, Mr. Mayor, that if you're going to be commenting on the MLPA, comment on the Central Coast MLPA, not something we might be doing sometime in the future up here.
And I apologize for that. My comments were to that, and we're going to
okay.
then direct us to here.
Thank you.
We don't like it.
I noticed.
I also would add that we do encourage written submissions, and if you have them, please give them to the staff at the end of the table.
They're actually far more effective than listening to someone speak, because then you can read it and think about it.
We have Sue Lescue, followed by Mel McKinney, followed by Lydia Evers.
Yes, my name is Sue Lescue. I live in Eureka, and I'm here today as a private citizen. I support the Commission's preferred alternative from August 2006 for the Central Coast Marine Protected Areas. It represents a balanced compromise among the three alternatives that will provide long-term benefits to fisheries and the ocean environment. A network of MPAs off the California coast would improve effective management of this valuable resource. MPAs not only help safeguard biodiversity, they also benefit fisheries and people. The preferred alternative for the Central Coast is based on years of collecting and analyzing the best readily available science and considering input from stakeholders and the public. I urge you to keep the MPA network strong in order to conserve wildlife, preserve habitat, and protect marine creatures off the Central California coast. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lescue.
Mel McKinney, followed by Lydia Evers, followed by Tim Marisich.
My name is Mel McKinney. I'm a Humboldt Bay advocate, but I'm also a member of the Ocean Conservancy, and I am a member of the North Coast Environmental Center, Sierra Club, Redwood Region, Audubon, Epic, and Baykeeper. And I do a lot of monitoring on Humboldt Bay, but being a ocean conservator, I feel that the area that's a central coast is one of the areas that we need to protect in order to bring back our fishery. And the one thing I see missing here is the pelagic fishing. And because I see it up and down the coast, where we don't have the herring, we don't have the small pelagic fish that are feeding the salmon. And when I read about orcas coming down from Oregon and Washington to feed on salmon in Humboldt Bay and along the eastern coast here, or western coast of California, I begin to wonder, are we going to protect anything even with our best MPAs? And it's been a hard-fought battle, but I'm in total support of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McKinney.
Lydia Evers, followed by Tim Marisich, followed by Brandy Easter.
My name is Lydia Evers. I'm a Humboldt State oceanography student. And I would just like to say that I'm in support of the MPAs, and I believe that we should either keep the MPAs current as what we're what you're discussing with the, I believe, 8.5, 8.6%, or increase it to the 12%, because it's very important to create the network that we need to regenerate the fisheries to further encourage the economy for the fishermen around. If the fisheries aren't there, it doesn't matter how many MPAs we have. There won't be any fish to fish. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Evers.
Tim Marisich, followed by Brandy Easter, followed by Vivian Hellowell.
Tim Marisich, commercial fisherman, Moss Landing. I wish to address some inaccuracies I've previously heard testify before you. I've referenced scientific literature correcting these unfounded statements. And previously, I hope I've been able to dispel the $7,000 you EcoTrust assigned my fishery. Rockfish. Attached is a 2002 CDF&G rockfish bycatch report summary. Its results show that spot prawn trapping does not impact species of overfished rockfish. Also, spot prawn trap fishing was enrolled in the Federal Observer Program in 2004 and 5. As of 2006, our fishery was no longer required to participate in the Federal Observer Program. Spot prawn trapping was and still is allowed to fish in the rockfish conservation area closures. Spot prawns are not the bottom of the rockfish food chain in SoCal Canyon, Portuguese ledge. Adult prawns have few predators because of their ability to defend themselves, and juvenile prawns reside in the kelp canopies of much shallower water. Habitat degradation. Before the recent establishments of the rockfish conservation areas, SoCal and Portuguese ledge were very productive and heavily trawled areas. Prawn traps are small, lightweight, and are picked straight up off the bottom. Any impact is infinitesimal to what this area has sustained from previous trawling. There are naturally occurring landslides in SoCal Canyon. The bottom substrate in this area is inherently unstable. It's not granite rock, as is Carmel Canyon. There's freshwater fissures and earthquake potentials that promote underwater landslides. Whale interactions. Whale sightings in SoCal Canyon are predominantly in the late spring and summer during the time that spot prawn fishing is closed. Attached is a letter from Sanctuary Cruises, the local whale watching. You want me to stop here now?
Well, we have your submission, Tim.
Okay. Can I just finish one?
Please.
Our fishing industry cannot sustain the continuing over-concentration of effort and the undermining of its infrastructure. This continuing onslaught and broad-brushed, unjustified vilification of our fishing industry is destroying it. There's no influx of smart young recruits. My own kids, having raised them in the fishing industry, believe there is no longer a future for them, and sadly, so do I.
Understand. Thank you. Next.
Brandy Easter, followed by Vivian Hellowell, followed by Ms. Catherine Schmidt.
Hi, I'm Brandy Easter.
She couldn't make it, but she wanted to speak on the spearfishing contest aspect of some of the alternatives and counter some of the propaganda you heard last meeting. So,
all right.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jim.
Vivian Hellowell, followed by Ms. Catherine Schmidt, followed by Russell Miller.
Hi, I'm Vivian Hellowell. I fished commercially for salmon out of Fort Bragg for 20 years, and my husband fishes crab out of Humboldt Bay here. And I want to remind you of a letter that was CC'd to you from the Pacific Fisheries Management Council a couple of months ago, pointing out that the economic studies, the economic impacts of these MPAs have not been well looked into on the fisheries. We've suffered 85% to 90% attrition in the salmon fleet, and I've watched the coastal communities collapse, the economies around the fishing. We've lost our infrastructure. We've lost our world markets. And the people who have managed to diversify and stay in the fisheries are just barely managing to do so. These marine protected areas have a great impact on coastal communities. And the management of fisheries that's already in place hasn't had a chance to work. We have rockfish rebuilding. Stock rebuilding programs that have only been in place for a few years. We've had major buybacks of trawlers, and I see that there may be a problem in getting funding for enforcement for these marine protected areas. Can we drive through them in our boats with fish on the boat for safety when they're in close and we need to get by there? I'm not sure how that works. So I think there's some things that need to be looked into further. Also, the benefits and adverse effects of marine protected areas have not been thoroughly investigated yet in terms of what happens when you push fisheries off of certain areas into other areas and concentrate the fishing in other areas.
And I'm Thank you, Ms. Hazel.
Copy
Ms.
of this letter to look at.
Thank you. Ms. Catherine Schmidt, followed by Russell Miller, followed by Skip McMaster.
Who all is here?
It looks like Catherine Schmidt actually gave us a written submission on
okay,
the back
fine.
Of card.
Do that.
Russell Miller, followed by Skip McMaster, followed by Archie Pons.
Thank you, Commissioners. I've salmon fished for...
I'm sorry, you need to identify yourself.
Okay, my name is Russell Miller, commercial fisherman. Fished 30 to 40 years. Commercial salmon fishing mainly has been my occupation. I took a 90% hit last year as the opportunity to fish. I want to thank you for the opportunity to maybe fish this next year. Fished 10 days. 10 days last year. 90% hit on my income. My major income is from salmon. These marine protected areas, I like to talk about the area that's pointed out right now below Pigeon Point. You anchor at the wharf and you fish Pigeon Point and Ana Nuevo. That's right where we salmon fish. When the wind's blowing, that's where we can catch some fish and make some money. That area, I'm totally against it. I'm very scared about the Marine Protection Agency area concept, and because basically as fishermen, fish move, and we're always fishing a food chain thing. Usually the rocky areas where the feed builds up, and it's very easy to be regulated out of the fish totally. And you know, once you put a line in the ocean, how do you regulate that line? How do you monitor the fishermen? It costs a lot of money to monitor these closure areas, and I feel it would be the final nail in the coffin of the commercial fishermen. As we did our taxes this year, it was pretty self-evident that we as commercial fishermen cannot take any more substantial hits as to the economics. That little thing, the canary, that the commercial fisherman is a miner's canary. Well, let's keep the fishermen alive and fishing, and I thank you for the opportunity maybe to have a season next year.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Skip McMaster, followed by Archie Pons, followed by Bill James.
Yeah, my name's Skip McMaster. I'm a commercial fisherman here out of Eureka now, but I've been fishing for about 30 years, and 20 of them out of Moss Landing. Moved up here about 10 or 12 years ago. And I happen to notice, looking at your areas, that the areas that you're protecting or proposed under these MPAs, like Russ said, are the areas that we primarily fish, especially that area around Pigeon Point right there. You know, that's where we've always fished. That's the anchorages right there. And traditionally, the larger fish have been caught in that area right there. Now, when you get up above that, up off the Farallon Islands, there's usually a bunch of real small fish, and there's mortality rates for fishing on those fish. And I think that there's a lot of things you guys are not looking at. You know, now, if you force everybody to fishing on where the small fish are at, you're going to be destroying your next year's crop a year ahead of time, every year. You're going to be fishing in the areas where the juveniles hang out. And you're also going to be endangering fishermen by making them fish farther from the anchorage, farther from shore, and especially in the windy areas. You're not going to be able to work. A lot of the small boats are not going to be able to work in those areas. And, you know, we've put so many things into place, like with the rock cod and stuff, and I don't think we're looking at how quick things are coming back. I fished down there a couple years ago and noticed that the bokkaches and the chili peppers are coming back in numbers like I haven't seen in probably 20 years, but I don't hear anything about that. You know, are they doing studies to see that these things that we've already put in place are working? Or are we just going to hammer the fishermen some more? Because the fishermen aren't going to be able to take it. I mean, if you look at traditionally how many fishermen work this coast and how many are working it now, it's pretty sad to think that this great resource that we have won't sustain the few fishermen that we have left. There's something wrong. I think that we're going too far the other way. For years and years and years, we didn't protect anything. Like the draggers were fishing wide open, and we have a lot of lost gill nets around on the other side of Monterey, where there was just, you know, maybe we should try to, you know, recover some of these gill nets and, you know, and wait and see how these other things work.
Thank you, Mr. McMaster.
Thank you.
Archie Pons, followed by Bill James, followed by Jerry Sato.
Good morning, Commissioners. Archie Pons, Port San Luis Commercial Fishermen's Association. I'm also the major live fish buyer at Port San Luis. And all I want to ask you again is to move this line back down to Zone 4, 3441.9. And we need this to sustain our fishery, to keep our markets from buying from foreign countries and other states. I support what Bill James is going to tell you, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pons. Bill James.
Commissioners, again, welcome to North of 4010. My name is Bill James. I'm a nearshore commercial fisherman, former member of statewide interest group of the MLPAI initiative for the South Central region. I'm here today representing Port St. Louis Commercial Fishing Association and myself. I have one major request to ask the commission and some alternatives for the South Central MPA list. First, I ask the commission to move the northern boundary of the Vandenberg SMR to 34 degrees 41.9. Now that, this is presently the northern boundary of Vandenberg Danger Zone 4. It's been closed for 20 years. Danger Zone 4 has been closed for 20 years. It's a 9-mile stretch of the coast, and I would ask you to move that boundary back to that. The reef is structured between 34 degrees, 41.9, and the commission's preferred alternative is extremely important to the nearshore commercial fishermen, especially the deeper nearshore permittee holders, because that's the permit that they hold, and that's where our major grouping of fish that we catch. Archie is a major fish buyer. It's 40%. Those 2.25 miles is 40% of the landings of the deeper nearshore in Avila. It's also extremely important for the CPFVs out of Avila and Morro Bay, and also some of the Morro Bay commercial fishermen. It is approximately 20 to 40% of the ex-vessel value landings for those ports. Secondly, if the commission decides not to move the boundary to the requested designation, I request that the Fish and Game Commission phase in Vandenberg SMR after the appropriate biological, habitat, and economic information is gathered. At this time, there has not been adequate economic information, and I'd like to see a cost-benefit analysis.
Thank you. We have your summary. Thank you very much. Jerry Sato?
Yeah, I'm giving my time to Bill James.
You did? Yeah. You want to finish your statement then?
Yes, sir.
You were...
Right. There's plenty of reef area. Plenty of reef area associated with a deeper nearshore finfish within Danger Zone 4. That's 9 miles. I have a map there. Unfortunately, we can't get it up, but I did bring a chart. There's 9 miles of reef that's already protects the deeper nearshore species. Thirdly, as far as other changes recommended by Tom Hafer and the CFC, I wish to endorse those changes. If the Fish and Game chooses it's a preferred alternative, there will be too much effort condensed into a smaller space, which most likely will cause overfishing in the left areas open to fish, thus defeating the purpose of the MLPA, that is to increase the fish biomass for the whole ecosystem of the whole region, not just the MPA areas. There also may be more impact on some overfish species in rebuilding plans, especially canary rockfish.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
David Bitts, followed by Jim Martin, followed by Mike Zamboni.
Thank you. I just want to make two points, and I hope I can stay in the time. The first is I hope that in adopting your final alternative, you will carefully consider what you are protecting habitat from and what you are protecting the fish stocks from. And I know that you are aware, and I hope that everybody here and everybody engaged in this issue is aware that these MPAs are not going to protect one fish from high seas long lines. They're not going to protect one fish from trawl because those things happen outside of 3 miles. And I suspect that many of the expectations for these areas are based on practices that have been changed in the past 10 years and that in many people's minds, these areas are being implemented to protect fish stocks and habitat that are already protected by other measures that have recently been taken. That's the first point I wanted to make. The second, I'm a little concerned that there may eventually or immediately be some blurring of lines as to the difference between what you can and cannot do in these areas. It looks like there are some areas where some fishing will be allowed. One of the areas, Año Nuevo, is the primary anchorage for the salmon fleet. If we're not allowed to anchor there, that's the end of the salmon fishery in that part of the state, because that is between Half Moon Bay and Santa Cruz. That's about it for where you can anchor, and that's a long run for 7-knot boats. And I know that in federal enforcement issues that come up at the Pacific Fishery Management Council, the enforcement people need simplicity and clarity in order to do their job. And a lot of times that means if there's a boat in that area, that boat's in violation. And I fear that that could also happen in state waters if, for example, salmon trolling is allowed at Soquel Hole, but it won't be because the boat there is seen to be in violation. He's there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Ugaritz?
This has come up twice now, and I think it's best to let the public understand what the reality is. Anchoring in and transit through marine protected areas with catch on board is allowed. That's already in regulation. We're not proposing changing that regulation. It has been effective and worked for our enforcement in other areas, and that's what's there.
Thank you for saying that. I was thinking it, and I didn't know when I would interject it. Yes, thank you. Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Vice President Rogers and fellow commissioners. My name is Jim Martin. I'm with the Recreational Fishing Alliance. And I'd like to throw out a request to increase or actually return the bag limit for this region that you're affecting with these MPAs. Increase the bag limit to 15 rockfish in the management zone from Point Conception to Point Lopez. If I'm a private boater from Fresno, let's say, and I have a choice to go to Morro Bay or Half Moon Bay, and I look at these closures, and I have to make an additional run to get to the fishing grounds, why would I ever want to fish there? And I think that this is within your authority to do within state waters. We've heard a lot of testimony about how this is going to be beneficial to fishermen, and I don't see it. So maybe we can give something back as an incentive to keep this port alive. On some specific changes to the preferred alternative, I'd like to ask that you make the changes suggested by Howard Egan and Dan Wolford about Año Nuevo, that little quarter-mile buffer around the island, rather than continuing that thing up the coast is really burdensome. And one of the sub-options on the Andrew Madera State Beach, that you have an option there. We'd like to allow fishing in that little area. And the California Fisheries Coalition will be submitting a letter more specifically to these changes. My time is running out here. I'm going to be careful about going over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Mike Zamboni, followed by Ed Salcedo, followed by Steve Shimmick.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Mike Zamboni, representing California Commercial Beach Fishermen's Association, Trinidad Bay Fishermen's Association, and a lot of commercial and recreational fishermen that couldn't come to the meeting today because of...
I've never seen that shirt.
Because they had to work.
Is that a one-off?
This is, yeah, a one-off. You'll be seeing more of them.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to start out by saying I did call the commission and did get a number of the time of 11 o'clock. And that's the information that's been advertised. I have it all documented as for when to people to come here, when this would begin.
It didn't come from the commission.
I'll take your word for it.
Well, let's put it this way. It's our policy, and it has been for the last 50 years, that we never publish a start time for exactly this reason. I mean, start time, but never when anyone's going to be in the middle of it.
Oh, okay.
For exactly this reason. Because
right.
Because we get this. People say this to us almost every single meeting. And it was usually information that was promulgated by someone else looking at our agenda and thinking when that might occur. Anyway, go ahead, please.
Anyway.
I'm very sorry if okay. You were misdirected.
Okay. let me start out by saying that the NOAA Fisheries has come out with its, as of 2005, the Pacific and North Pacific Councils have no SOX subject to overfishing. That's in the NOAA Fisheries document that came out. So closing this for biological reasons is completely unnecessary. While we support the proposed measures to allow for increasing fishing and kelp harvesting opportunities within the proposed Central Coast MPAs, we're opposed to the creation of the MPAs themselves. We believe the proposed MPAs will result in an effort to shift to weaker groundfish and salmon stocks living outside state waters and possibly result in a complete closure of the West Coast ground fishery. As you know, none of the 19 species of nearshore fish are listed as overfished, endangered, depleted, or any other designation that would necessitate further management measures or creation of new MPAs in nearshore waters. Unfortunately, a few stocks are shelf slope species, specifically canary, yellow eye, and dark blotch rockfish are rebuilding but continue to be officially designated as overfished. These species occur outside state waters, and by closing nearly 20% state waters to fishing, you will shift effort from healthy nearshore stocks to weaker shelf and slope stocks. This effort shift will result in increased bycatch of these species, and if the allowable catch is surpassed, the entire West Coast ground fishery, sport, and commercial may be closed. This regulatory effort shift from a healthy stock to a weaker one is both unwise from a biological standpoint and violates the Magnuson-Stevenson Act. Under current management, it is impossible to overfish a rockfish or any other fish species because in modern management, an OY for optimum yield for every species or complex has been set.
When I took your time, but I've given it back. Would you summarize now, please?
Okay. The term MPA, Marine Protected Area, itself is a misnomer. MPAs don't provide protection to an area. They only ban fishing, which is of minimal impact to California fish stocks. Oceanic conditions, dead zones, pollution, development, and pinniped population, twice its historical levels, are the real cause of fish declines. If you need an example of this, look at the Klamath Management Zone. 144-mile square block has been closed, plus 300 miles of coastline, and look where we are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ed Salcedo, followed by Steve Shimmick, followed by Douglas Bush.
Ed Salcedo, commercial fisherman. I have a video, and while they're setting it up, I guess I can go and speak. But
How long is your video?
It's only going to be 3 minutes, I guess. You know,
2 minutes.
Or you're down 2 minutes now. But anyway, while they're setting it up, I asked the commissioners, do you really know what you folks are doing and what the implications of closing these areas really is? Now, the Constitution calls for so much closure in through the Constitution, and you're adding to it. Now, this video here is the part of the Wildlands Project, and what you're doing is you're taking the Wildlands Project out to the ocean, where they want their islands, they want their corridors, and this is it's not about fishing. It's about control of our resources, and I think you gentlemen that aren't fishermen ought to look at this thing. This was by Dr. Kaufman. He's investigated the Wildlands Project. It's true and it's real. And I think it's an eye-opener.
Well, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to see it because of the time limitation.
Have you
made a submission? 2 minutes. No. Two.
Well,
I need to have your names, and we have to find your cards.
Go to the introduction first, if you would.
What are your names who are giving up your time period? And I'm presuming you have a card, because if you don't give it up. What is your name? Okay. No, and the other name?
Duke Gifford.
Thank you.
Now, by them, you know, not being able to get the, you know, this, it's a valid... Anyway, like I said, you commissioners that are appointed, you're not fishermen, and you're buying into...
You mean we're not commercial fishermen?
No, you're not. Well, yeah, you're sports fishermen, but you're not commercial. Yeah. You don't have a stake in this. And when they take our resources, and it's the general environmental movement, 55% of California is already under control of government. Now they want to go out into the ocean and take 20, 30, 40% of our fishing waters. I think it's something to be looked at. It's real. It's not just about closures. It's about taking the resources.
What's How are we doing? Are we getting? Are we being technically challenged, or what's happening here? What is it? I'm sorry, Steve.
I don't know what format.
Well, I'm sure you looked at it before when I was They gave it to you earlier to view it to see if it was acceptable to show. So I'm sure you had it up at some point.
We'll have to put it.
I'll tell you, you know, if you commissioners would go to Taking Liberty, it's stewarts.us. This, I believe, it's eye-opening into what's happening to our country.
Excuse me, I'll take my time back.
But, yeah, no, like I said, I mean, yeah, I'm
too
sure,
late.
I'm sure he viewed it before. They, in fact, they said they were going to view it before they put it on the screen to see if it was acceptable to be put on
the
screen.
I'm sorry, there seems to be a technical problem with it.
As there is in a lot of things. Please look into it and see what you're doing, because I don't believe you know what you're doing, because these staff is running the show, giving you recommendations, and I've been to a lot of commission meetings, and the commissioners buy into it, but there's a lot behind it. I ask that you look at it. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Steve Shimmick, followed by Douglas Bush, followed by Tom Hafer.
Commissioners and staff, my name is Steve Shimmick. I am executive director of the Otter Project. Welcome, Commissioner Hanna. I simply want to remind us where we've been and how far we've come. 2 years ago, a group of conservation organizations, you know, kind of got together and trying to, you know, we knew this thing was coming. And we kind of mapped out areas of interest. And it came out to about 46% of the coast. And we knew that that wasn't a reasonable proposal, but, you know, that was just kind of, that's what people had an interest in. And then, as some of you know, Caitlin Gaffney and I worked together, and we proposed, and many others, and we put together a proposal, Proposal 2. And that was about 12% of the coast. And that was a negotiated proposal. Some of the areas like Año Nuevo that we're talking about, we gave up areas closer to the Santa Cruz Harbor so that we could get Año Nuevo. That was negotiated with the recreational fishermen. The area to the south that there's been talk about the northern boundary at Point Pedernales, 7/8 of that reef is open in the current proposal, and that's because of a negotiated agreement. But now people want more. So just kind of think of where we've been, where we've come from, and how much negotiation has gone into this. Please do not reduce below the August preferred alternative. It is actually already a step back, and a negotiated step back, from what the Blue Ribbon Task Force recommended to you was already the appropriate compromise. So this has been negotiated, renegotiated. Things like opening up spot prawn fishing in Soquel Canyon Portuguese Ledge, just don't do it. You've got 15% bycatch in those spot prawn traps of exactly the resources you're trying to protect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt.
Douglas Bush, followed by Tom Hafer, followed by Samantha Murray.
Good morning, commissioners. Douglas Bush, representing the cultured abalone farm in Santa Barbara County. Welcome, Commissioner Hanna. I'd like to speak specifically to sub-option 4 as outlined by John Ugaretz, as things still open and tabled to the implementation of the proposed marine protected areas. Our kelp bed 208, as I submitted comments at the Monterey meeting, two items were sort of tabled at the Monterey meeting that I'd like to rebut. And one of them is the sustainability of kelp harvesting in general. I was happy to hear John Ugaretz sort of make a statement that of the department's support of kelp harvesting as a sustainable. But I have some data from the long-term ecological research lab from UC Santa Barbara, Dan Reed's lab. There's more kelp is lost just through natural dynamic processes in one day than we harvest in a month. It's the definition of sustainability. It's not just sustainable. It's sustainable by several orders of magnitude. The second item that I'd kind of like to rebut was that kelp harvesting is in some way at odds with the goals of the Marine Protected Area Initiative. And the kelp leasing program along the Central Coast is defined by small leases. The continuity of kelp, if you look at outside of the leased beds and outside of the small intersections between leases and proposed marine protected areas, essentially everything is a marine protected area because of the unfeasibility of harvesting kelp from every other area. The northern portion of our bed, 208, where it intersects with the proposed Cambria State Marine Reserve, we need that from a flexibility standpoint. We almost never go there. It's kind of a non-issue in a lot of ways because, you know, it's further from port. It's more expensive for us, but we need it for flexibility. There are those years where it's all bull kelp in the south, and we need to go there. And we're willing to work with this as much as possible. So I just ask for flexibility and a certain amount of recognition of the history of kelp harvesting and the good standing thereof. Thank you,
Mr. Bush.
Tom Hafer, followed by Samantha Murray, followed by Brandy Easter.
Welcome, commissioners, and welcome to Mr. Hanna. My name's Tom Hafer. I've been a commercial fisherman since 1972. I fish out of Morro Bay, California. I'm a nearshore fisherman and a spot prawn fisherman there. I just want to talk a little bit about Andrew Madera State Beach. It's in the Big Sur area, the Big Sur Reef, you want to call it. I've been fishing that area now for about 13 years for nearshore and outside there for spot prawns. The Andrew Madera State Beach is about a one-mile walk from the parking lot to the beach. You have kayakers that go fishing, a lot of families, fathers and sons that come fishing up there, beach fishing off the shore there. You have 30 horses, probably 6-7 times a day walking through that beach area right there. A lot of the public use that beach, and if you were to pick that commission's package P that stops at Falser, that beach would still be open. The fishermen would still have access to some of the reef. That proposal takes the biggest and best part of the reef and the kelp. So if you leave that little bit of sand and outcroppings of rock, it'll still let the public fish, the sport guys fish, and the nearshore guys fish there a little bit. That's about all for there, and I still support all the changes that I've been pushing here for the last 6 months or whatever. You know, one little thing that I don't know if you commissioners know about, you know, EcoTrust, they came to our town, and they said, okay, you guys, we're going to give you 100 pennies, and you're going to tell us where you fish at, and we're not going to take those spots from you. So, you know, we were kind of hesitant in doing that, but we all got together in a meeting, and you know, we all decided, well, let's tell them so we can kind of protect our fishing grounds. So we told them. And, you know, lo and behold, that's where all the reserves are. It's crazy. I mean, they didn't know where we fished, so actually they lied to us by telling them, we'll trust you and don't take our fishing grounds if you tell us. And they totally went the other way, and they lied to us, and they just took them all.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, thank you.
Samantha Murray, followed by Brandy Easter, followed by Roger Anderson.
Good morning. My name is Samantha Murray, and I'm with the Ocean Conservancy. And on behalf of our 25,000 California members, I just want to commend your leadership on the MLPA initiative and really thank you for your work so far. This really has been one of the most inclusive processes that California has ever undertaken. The South Central Coast Project is the result of painstaking compromise from both sides and ocean stakeholders. We urge you not to support the options to allow kelp harvest at Año Nuevo or Cambria. This would eliminate two of the proposed reserves, reducing protection from high to moderate at Año Nuevo and high to low at Cambria. We also urge you not to support the options to allow spot prawning. in Soquel Canyon and Portuguese Ledge. This, again, would reduce the level of protection from high to moderate. Regardless of the direct foreseeable impacts of allowing these options, they would upset the delicate balance of the entire network and compromise the scientific integrity of the entire network. We do sympathize with the difficulty the fishermen have been encountering, believe the Central Coast Project is a first step in recovering populations, protecting entire ecosystems, and enhancing our coastal waters for all Californians. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Murray. Would the gentlemen in the hall please take their conversations outside? Thank you.
Brandy Easter, followed by Roger Anderson, followed by Rick Elpert.
I understand I might have had an imposter here, but this is the real Brandy Easter. Commissioners, my name is Brandy Easter, and in addition to being an abalone diver, I thoroughly enjoy freediving for fish along the California coastline. I'm also a member of the Central California Council of Dive Clubs, and I first want to start out by saying thank you. Thank you for all of your hard work over the last 10 years. There's been some hard and tough decisions, reduction of bag limits, and reduction of seasons. But we've seen results from that. We're seeing more fish, so thank you for those efforts. But even with those reduced bag limits, amazingly, in 2002, National Spearfishing Championships that were held in Carmel produced the highest scores and biggest fish ever seen. And that's really something when you consider that you, for the limit of lingcod and rockfish, they were cut in half and cabezon went from 10 to 1. SINCAL competitions and dive meets date back to the early 50s. And the organizers have worked closely with the Department of Fish and Game, most recently with Dave Ventresca, who has been at every one of the tournaments on the Monterey Peninsula, aging and grading the fish. Some of the best data of the nearshore fin fish stocks come from these catch per unit efforts. And from all of this data, we also know that the fishery is healthy, and we know that our catch records over all that time hasn't changed very much. I'm disturbed by some of the statements I keep hearing about non-consumptives.
The federal government estimates that over 40% of the land...
That was an interesting introduction.
I think Steve's become unchallenged.
Yeah. I'll start again. I'm disturbed by some of the statements I keep hearing that non-consumptive divers have been making about our competitions. I've heard that they are accusing us of dumping fish and engaging in wasteful practices. That could mean nothing further from the truth. We are very responsible about our catch, and we do not waste fish. Contrary to what I've been told by these, we actually take fewer fish. I'll conclude because I heard the beep. Please continue your good work on behalf of the resources and basing your decisions on sound science and the fairness for all user groups. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Easter.
Roger Anderson, followed by Rick Elgert, followed by Michelle Leary.
I'm Roger Anderson. My family's been in San Luis Obispo County since the 1860s. For the last 40 years, we've operated a seafood restaurant on the waterfront in Morro Bay. We specialize in fresh local seafood, and I still get a lot of joy in not only educating our visitors about the seafoods that are caught locally and the difference between wild fish and farmed fish, but also in telling them where they're going to encounter sea otters and elephant seals and all of the other things that our coastline has to offer. All local businesses are affected by what happens in fishing. The trickle-down effect of the dollars is very clear. And many of our visitors do come for the fishing and the seafood. Now, I've served four terms on the Morro Bay City Council, two of them as mayor. I'm the chair of the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board. And I originated the Harbor of Refuge Bill, which now takes in many of the ports and harbors along the coast. So I have been involved in these coastal matters for a long time. As an elected official, I came to realize that compromises are often the best decisions that a board can make. And as a businessman, I know your decision will affect me and countless others. Please consider carefully your decisions. We all support sustainable fisheries. Sustainability on the Central Coast can be accomplished with a little bit less restrictive package. Please find the strength and compassion to find a compromise instead of the currently recommended package. I really think that you'll find that the fishermen want to sustain the fishing grounds in a big way, but in that Central Coast area, we need to have the ability for them to survive and the businesses that are dependent survive. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Rick Elgert, followed by Michelle Leary, followed by Stan Trapp.
Good morning, commissioners. Thanks for the opportunity to address you again. I can't top Roger, so I'll be brief. We ask you to again, I'm sorry, Rick Elgert, City of Morro Bay Harbor Director. And we ask you to consider the mayor of City of Morro Bay's letter of January 26, 2007, especially the changes requested in the preferred network. Also, the adoption of the preferred network will have significant impacts on our community. We think that at least those changes would be helpful in reducing those impacts and helping us transition that we all see we need to make and hopefully keeping fishing alive in our coastal communities. If you could consider also a 15-bag limit increase for the recreational sport fishermen, that would be helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Albert.
Michelle Leary, followed by Stan Trapp, followed by Emily Utter.
Hi, I'm Michelle Leary. I'm a sport fishing captain in Morro Bay. I have some additional petitions, if anybody wants them.
Turn them into staff funds. Thank you.
Also, in accordance with the MLPA guidelines for the 30 to 60 mile spacing apart, I would like to support getting rid of the Cambria State Marine Reserve. It's approximately 30 miles from Bouchon to San Simeon Reserves. And also, I'd like to support all the changes in the letter from the mayor of Morro Bay. And I'd also like to support an increased bag limit to 15 fish so we can justify the fishing trip prices, which will reflect the increased fuel consumption for the areas we have to drive around to get to the fish. And once again, I'd just like to say these small changes here are going to be very helpful to us since the MLPAs will be set on a large percentage of our reefy, rocky area where the fish populations are. Thanks.
Thank you.
Stan Trapp, followed by Emily Utter, followed by Chanel Shani.
Yes, my name is Stan Trapp, and I'm in business in Morro Bay. I'm not a fisherman. I own a shopping complex called Marina Square on the Embarcadero. I'm also owner of a restaurant called Windows on the Water, which overlooks Morro Bay and our famous rock. I'd like to address fishing from a couple of perspectives. From a business perspective, while the majority of other stores in Marina Square and on the Embarcadero rely upon recreational fishing for their traffic, Windows on the Water and some of the other restaurants rely upon the product of the commercial fishermen. To be sure, Windows has other items on their menu besides fish, but our drying cart is fish, fresh and local. Fresh seafood comprises 4 out of 5 of our top sellers, and in 206, seafood, including shellfish, made up 65% of our regular menu. Our customers come from all over the state, but they all come for the same reason, to sample our freshly caught local product. With our fresh and local, which distinguishes us from inland restaurants and is the core to our menu and necessary for our success. From a health perspective, the obesity in the United States has reached epidemic portions. To combat that statistic, our government is encouraging people to eat lighter and healthier. Certainly high on the list of recommended food is seafood. Many people are responding to their message, and consumption of seafood is increasing, and people are ordering seafood on a more frequent basis. To encourage that trend, we want to supply our customers with the best possible seafood, and the best is fresh and local. The majority of the seafood in one of our seafood suppliers, Fasciola Company, supports our opinion. They say that fresh and local on their extensive list of fish means immediate sellout. Our chef tells me that she will always supply local fish whenever available, even at a premium. From a heritage perspective, the same logic of, applies to our local fishermen. Like farming, fishing is a multi-generational business. Fishermen are attempting to pass on to the skills acquired from previous generations, aligned with current practices, to their children, the next generation of fishermen. The modern farmers learn that it's up to them to manage their land, take a reasonable harvest, but preserve the species for future generations. From a perspective of business, health, and heritage, it's time to consider the ancient tradition of fishermen equally with the concerns for the environment. Reasonable quotas, sustainable fishing practices, and productive fishing areas which allow for reasonable profit are all this generation of fishermen are asking.
Thank you, Mr. Trent.
Emily Utter, followed by Chanel Channing, followed by Gary Thurston. Chanel Channing, followed by Gary Thurston, followed by Sally Flanagan.
Thank you. I'm just going to cover a few points of the letter from the mayor of Morro Bay. As mayor of Morro Bay...
I'm sorry, you need to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Chanel Channing.
It's for the record.
Oh.
Thank you.
Okay. As mayor of Morro Bay, a fishing village struggling to survive, I urge you to consider the devastating effect of the fishing closures are having on this and other communities. In recent years, revenue from fishing is estimated to have dropped from $10 million annually to $3 million, and it is still falling, a heavy hit for a city of 10,000 people and an annual operating budget of $19 million. This revenue decline and business collapse occurs while fishing stocks are clearly rebounding due to aggressive resource protection and fishery management actions in the last 10 years. Our tourist industry, the main source of revenue in our town, has been drastically reduced by the loss of fishing activity as a draw for visitors. The statement of the CEQA review that these reserves will have no cultural impact totally ignores the fact that fishing is the very basis of Morro Bay's history and heritage, and the loss of which is very much a cultural impact. Please consider the following changes and allow the fishing industry to survive. Big Sur, change the southern border up to the Big Sur Rock. Please note that Point Lobos and Big Creek reserves are both within the 10 miles of Point Sur. Piedras Blancas, a small line change in the northern border town of Harlech Castle Rock. A little more space to the near shore fishery of Morro Bay. Cambria, reduce or eliminate the Cambria State Marine Reserve. The 3R design only allows for 3.5 miles of commercial near shore fishing between Point Estero and the light. Based on the science guidelines for spacing 3 to 60 miles apart and avoiding reserves close to the port, the Cambria State Marine Reserve is not necessary since reserves at Piedras Blancas, Point Bouchon, and Cambria Sport Park are already established. And Prisma, bring the northern border down to the 34-degree line. As you deliberate on these issues, considering this question.
Yeah, you need to summarize.
Okay, I'm just finishing up. Considering this question. How can destroying our local fishery industry and eliminating the state and local revenue generated by these catches possibly be preferable to having to purchase foreign caught fish where no regulations may apply at all? There simply is no logic.
Thank you.
And tragedy will result. Thank you.
As I've said before, turning your submissions in writing is recommended. Especially when it's detailed like that, a written
submission.
Well, that
submission. One, I believe, was submitted to the...
Gary Thurston, followed by Sally Flanagan, followed by Gene Owens.
I am Gary Thurston.
I'm sorry, to which gentleman?
Your name for the record?
Dennis Mayo. Thank you, Gary.
Wait. Wait, are those cards?
Wanted to finish my comments from earlier, and I thank the people for giving me
their
time.
Hang on a second. We do a little yes. Keeping here.
Yeah, Gary Thurston and Sally.
Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you for allowing me to finish my comments. As I was saying earlier, as fishermen and supporters of fishermen, we're here to object to the Central Coast Plan P and the number of MPLAs. And we're here to... ask you to accept all the proposed options. We have joined with affected local Central Coast fishermen in making specific written comments or joining in with their comments, so that's on record. But today I'd like to highlight some of the generalities of those comments. Number one, the money. As Mr. Salcido tried to say, that is proof of the agenda of this driven process by groups with more money than concern for fishermen or fish. The process. This of course, is a process-driven project. No matter how hard one tries, how hard you all try, and I know you do try hard, there's just going to be MLPAs. That's a flat-out fact. And that's what the process is designed to do. It's a flawed mission from the get-go, but we're stuck with it. Unless, of course, you're a career process person or an advocate of MPLAs, then you think it's a good process. The Central Coast is a case in point. I went to many of the economic and science sessions, and I read all of those findings that I did not attend. And from them, in my opinion and the opinion of the affected extended fishing communities, there is no basis for the extent of these MPLAs in the Central Coast area. In our opinion, that data proves conclusively one thing. These designations are a result of politics, not data. And I believe all of you might have an inkling of this because of the hue and public cry that arose and the change of your order of study areas. You're not going to go to the South because you know what a battle that's going to be. And the decision to change that up to this little northern area, in our opinion, is just a ploy to let the heat die down, and then you're going to start it again. Now, I'd like to say that those of us on the North Coast in this North Coast region realize that you're coming, but you need to realize that our nearshore fisheries are in excellent shape. We're going to be here with the scientific data to back that up, and we're going to have the people here in mass to object to this. Now, thank you, and I know you've got a tough job, but it is politics, and we can't deny that.
Now, Mr. Mayo, and no disrespect, and I hope everyone understands, the Blue Ribbon Task Force, which forwarded the recommendations to the Fish and Game Commission, and the Fish and Game Commission are acting under our responsibility to affect a law that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. So, yes, MLPAs are going to be, MLPA is going to be in existence, and MPAs resulting from that are going to be in existence. The only question is where, what they do, and all of that. I mean, we are affecting a law, so we have virtually no choice but to create, but to affect the MLPA, which then has various MPAs, which are sometimes on places where people fish and sometimes not. Anyway, just so that everyone understands that. Please don't be rude, or we'll ask you to be removed. Next speaker, please.
Gene Owens, followed by Charlie Nothoff, followed by Aaron Newman.
He did. We gave it back.
Okay.
You're welcome.
All that person did was open his mouth and he was asked to be removed.
No, I didn't ask him to be removed.
I got 2 minutes, right? I've seen a lot of begging from the people up here. The fact is, I want to talk mostly to the fishermen because this commission, like they say, they're just doing their duty. The Fish and Game has been sued all along the West Coast, and these lawsuits have been won. They've been won by commissioners in Coos Bay because the snowy plover is not endangered. It's a lie, and that's a legal grounds for a lawsuit if you want to go on that one. The other one is a bill of attainder. The United States Constitution, Article 1, 9, Section 9, Clause 3, says there shall be no bill of attainders. A bill of attainder, when you look it up in the legal definition, means you cannot get a pain or a punishment without a trial. The United States has individual rights. There's a foundation called the PacificLegalFoundation.org. I got their phone number here. You can get a class action lawsuit started, and this is the legal ground for it. The United States is a republic, and that means we have a written rule of law called the Constitution and the California Constitution. Just because the statutes have the color of law doesn't make them legal. What makes them legal is your silence. The American people do not need to beg to anyone because the Constitution doesn't form an oligarchy. There is no oligarchy. That means rule by few. There is no king. That means rule by one. I have paperwork to pass out to fishermen. My time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owen.
Charlie Nothoff, followed by Aaron Newman.
May I reiterate something? No disrespect to Mr. Owen. It is critically important that you give commentary with respect to the Central Coast MLPA allotments. Otherwise, this is wasted time.
It all comes under the Constitution, folks. Don't let them divide you. When the gorilla's in your home, it's not supposed to
Please
be there.
Please get off the microphone, sir.
Yeah, the black helicopters are following you. I understand.
Charlie Nothoff, followed by Aaron Newman, followed by Kirk Yonker.
Good morning. My name's Charlie Nothoff. I was one of the members, of the original Humboldt-Del Norte Working Group back when you were seriously seeking local input to make local decisions. I was a representative of the recreational diving community, so I don't have the economic, there's no threat to my income based on your decisions. What I've always brought to the group is that I've had experience in, on, under the waters, ranging from La Jolla Shores up to Crescent City, so I'm very familiar with the waters of the state of California. And it seems your process now is to look at what works in Central California, a place where I've spent a lot of time under and on the waters, and take the lessons that you learned there and move them to the rest of the state. There's a number of people here, faces that I know, guys who would take you out on a boat right now and show you that our waters are not the waters of Monterey or not the waters of Southern California. All I want to say is before you make decisions about local our local area here, please get more local input than just giving people 2 minutes at a time. Yeah. What works in Monterey doesn't work in Humboldt County.
Understand, but once again, that's not the subject of today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron Newman, followed by Kirk Yonker.
Good afternoon. Thanks for this opportunity. My name is Aaron Newman. I'm president of Humboldt Fishermen's Marketing Association. The fishermen of California have to travel to the Central Coast to fish, especially for salmon. And any of these MPAs proposed in that area seek to hamper our efforts when we go there. The regulations are already keeping us from making good livings because of other constraints. These MPAs will do nothing that the current restrictions on gear, quotas, and seasons already do. All they will do in that area, if the MPAs are such that they don't allow commercial fishing in those zones, has caused us to leave the scene sooner than we probably already are. We ask that all areas that are no take be reconsidered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newman.
Kirk Yonker.
Yes, my name is Kirk Yonker, representing Pacific Choice Seafood. And I just want to go on record that our company is not in support of any MPAs along any coast. There's enough lines drawn in the ocean, and guys are having a hard enough time making a living. So we're not in support of any of this.
Thank you, Mr. Acker. And that's our last speaker. Do I have commentary for questions or concerns from the commission?
Well, I just want to make some comments about the testimony we heard today. There's been some comments made about the commissioners up here don't really understand what the fishermen are up against. And we've been, between this issue and the Channel Islands, we've grown to be able to understand what everybody's up against. And I want to make it clear that we as commissioners feel like that we represent all the citizens of the state of California, not just the legislature or the department or the environmentalists or the fishermen. We represent all of you. And for those who think we don't understand, my father and uncle were commercial salmon fishermen in the late 40s and early 50s. So I can relate a little bit to what you're talking about. I happen to believe that nobody knows how these things are going to work. And before we get too carried away, we need to give them an opportunity to work. And I believe that in this next phase, we should pick an area, and this would be a good one, to make it as open to all the fishermen, the commercial, the recreational, the sport fishing, the kelp, abalone, and everybody else as much as we possibly can, so we have something to compare with the rest of the MPAs that we've already set up and see if it makes a difference by allowing more fishing in some of the areas than others. So don't shoot yourself in the foot by getting emotional and losing your temper with us when you're doing the testimonies is the point I want to make here today, because we're listening, and ultimately there's five people that are going to make the final decision. And if you want us to make a wise decision, then be wise in your presentation to us.
Thank you, Commissioner Kellogg. From my perspective, I feel just exactly the same way Jim does, in the sense that I'm not complaining in any way. I mean, as you know, we're volunteers, but we put in egregious amounts of time. I mean, it's absolutely amazing how much time. We probably have between 8 to 10 inches of reading a meeting. And we do it because we care about it much the same way you guys do, you people do. We may not all come to the same conclusions, but Jim's point that we represent all the people of the state of California is a very important one to consider. Because all of the people of the state of California are not fishermen, either commercial or recreational. They're not even necessarily ocean people. But they have opinions, and they vote, and they talk to their legislators, and that's the people to whom we are directly, by law, responsible. So we are doing everything that we possibly can to do this right. We're obviously not going to please everyone, and in fact, I imagine there's virtually no one in this audience we have completely pleased. And we'll ultimately do so in April when we make a decision on this. But you're going to have to bear with us because we're really trying very hard. And the extent to which we're trying is actually evidenced by the fact that this is Commissioner Hanna's first meeting, but he's been at these meetings for a year prepping himself before he was even nominated. That's just an example of how seriously we all take this. Once again, we may not agree specifically with you guys on one point or another, but we are trying. Any comments? Okay, I would like to formally request of the department a little bit of a consideration for the next discussion, and this will be in April, where we are going to make our decision in Bodega Bay. I actually would like to, for the audience, for those people who are not here, who were stakeholders in the BRTF process, and for my fellow commissioners, make the following suggestions that I would like to see altered with respect to MPA boundaries. And at Prisima Point, I would recommend moving the northern boundary southward to 34 degrees, 44.3 minutes north. The MPA would still be well within the preferred size range. There would be a loss of mapped rocky habitat, but according to the fishermen, rockfish species are caught to the south in areas where no mapped rock exists. It would only reduce the size by less than 1.5 square miles, while allowing a full mile of shoreline between Prisima Point and the no-take MPA. That's one recommendation I'm making. Second recommendations at Point Bouchon. I would recommend moving the northern boundary southward to 35 degrees, 45.8 minutes north, and moving the south boundary northward to 35 degrees, 11.5 north. This would make the MPA fall out of this preferred size range, but still meet minimums by a good amount. Overall, it would reduce by 1.5 square miles on each end. However, if you consider the Diablo Canyon security zone, which you, in my mind, must, it then you chunk back 2.5 square miles into what is the MPA, which we cannot really consider as part of the MPA, but it is in effect part of the MPA. Okay, and then my last suggestion is I recommend moving the southern boundary. This is at Point Sur. I recommend moving the southern boundary northward to 36 degrees, 15.6 minutes north. This would remove approximately 2 square miles from the MPA, making it still fall within the Science Advisory Team's preferred size range, but give considerably more fishing opportunities to recreational and nearshore. And that was actually commercial. Those are my recommendations. I will hand these to the department so that you can take a look at them. But I would like to provide these for my fellow commissioners who have not seen them. Thank you. Good. Any further commentary? Next item.
Excuse Sankey? Me. For the record, could we get a vote on that? In other words,
no. These are just what I'm going to ask for.
Oh, is
I'm not. We don't vote on anything.
No, excuse me. What I'm asking is a vote of the commission, unanimous or a majority vote to add these items to the package, procedurally.
Procedurally.
Yeah, because okay. Right now I only have one member of the commission with this request, and
right,
technically, procedurally, it would help us if we had a commission vote.
These are within, by the way.
Yes.
The constraints of our notice.
Yes, it would be nice to have a record that the commission formally asked us through.
Well,
to
my
vote.
Commissioners who have just seen this for the first time.
No, I don't agree with Sankey. I don't think we need to vote on that, Sankey. This is no different than in the hunting regulations where one commissioner wants to add or recommend to the department to come back with
that. Well, let me rephrase that then. I'm taking that all three commissioners support this change, adding this alternative in there. Is that true?
Well, I can't speak to all three commissioners.
All I'm trying to...
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah.
Mr. Cunningham, do you want to speak to this?
I'm not sure that I wouldn't want it even to be more lenient than what commissioner... That's where I got to... That's a good start.
Mr. President, or Vice President Rogers, and members of the commission, Bill Cunningham, and Mr. Mastrup, I'm not sure this is necessarily going to require a formal motion or resolution of the commission to add these changes. I do think that, as Mr. Rogers indicated, his proposed changes are within the language of the regulation as already and the subsets as already noticed. And I think they, as many other changes, have always been added at any specific commissioner's request without requiring full commission agreement, again, because these are all within the existing scope of the notices and are as such only ministerial changes or editorial changes. I think they're probably appropriately added just by a commissioner's request. I see no problem if the commissioners all want to agree, at least with assenting to the premise that these kinds of changes should be added at this point in time. That is not a vote on the changes, but just that they should be incorporated for discussion purposes. So, Mr. Rogers, if you would like to ask for your fellow commissioners' understanding.
Do I have a proposal? Do I have a proposer?
I just make a motion that Commissioner Rogers' suggestions be included in the department's proposal package.
Is there a second?
Am I to understand that this is just something we're looking at? This is not something that we're going to...
Haven't voted. No vote.
Just should include it in the
package. Abstain because I don't understand it without looking at the big picture.
Okay.
And I think I'll do that. I think I'll abstain until I've seen this, until I understand what it is.
Second.
Aye.
Okay.
Thank you, commissioners.
Next item.
Moving to item number 19, consideration of requests from Donald Shirley and Melissa Lucas to amend Section 677, Title 14, to add California Valley Quail to the list of species which may be used for dog training purposes. Department.
All this is for discussion purposes.
Deputy Director Mastrip, do you want to make comments first, or should we let, we have the proposer here. Let,
that's all I'm doing. Why don't we wait until the room clears? We'll, why don't we take a 5-minute stand-up break?
Thank you. We're going to be with item number 19, consideration of requests from Donald Shirley and Melissa Lucas to amend Section 677, Title 14, to add California quail to the list of species which may be used for dog training purposes. At this point, we have one speaker, and this is the person who proposed this, Donald Shirley. Yes, Donald Shirley, if you could...
How much time have I got?
Explain your proposal.
Okay, I started this.
How much do you think? How much time do you think you need to?
I'll get done as quick as I can. I won't be that long.
Fifteen minutes
probably
max.
Probably not even that much.
Fine.
No.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm Donald Shirley. I live in Mojave, California. I started this back when you made the changes to the dog training regulations, probably about 4-3 years ago. And I got in right at the end, and I was persuaded not to pursue this because it would slow down the vote on that. When you change the regulations, it benefited me too, so I went ahead and did that. So I really would like to thank you for the opportunity to bring my views up on this particular subject. You have to kind of look at me as a breeder of quail, a dog trainer, and also a hunter. So I look at it from all those perspectives. I also got a hold of the objections from the Department of Fish and Game. And I thought what I did is I made a copy of that and I inserted my views or my arguments against it, against their reasons why we shouldn't be able to do that or what they felt why they were opposed to it. And I'll go down through that quickly. They say the alternate species are readily available. I only hunt quail, and so I like to just stay with quail. That's what I would train them with. I've trained them with a lot of different birds, pigeons, but basically quail. I've never used chucker and I've never used pheasant. Because one reason...
Is that because the flight pattern difference?
Well, I would have to pay for feeding the pheasants. They're big, they eat more, you get less birds. Chucker is the same way, okay? Quail, I can get quite a few and feed them as little as possible. So they talked... The two species of quail that they have in there, one of them does not fly very well at all. Now, anybody that sells them will tell you that right away. It may be good for young dogs, but it's not good for seasoned dogs. The bobwhite... Biggest problem with them is they tend to become accustomed to humans. And what happens is when they're young, let's say young adults, that they like to fly them because that's something new to them and they enjoy it. Later on, the adults go, well, gee, why fly when you can walk? You come out, you check the pen data, they get used to you. For an example, when I had some valley quail and I had some bobwhites mixed up in the same pen, and when I went in there, the bobwhites come running to me and the valley quail go running to the other end of the pen. And I'm going to bring that up later, why that's important. Where I live in the desert, the bobwhites, the reason with their, I don't think they have any populations of bobwhite in California, I'm not sure. But there's reasons for that. It's the habitat or the climate or whatever they just can't handle. It's very hard on them. During the summertime, I have some that lose an awful lot of feathers, and it looks terrible. Go through this every year. While the valley quail I have, they're accustomed to it, and they don't seem to have a problem with it. What I've noticed that is California valley quail seem to maintain their wild traits and their ability to fly, which is really what I need. I actually have bobwhite at home now. Basically, they're retired. They got room and board for the rest of their life because they're useless for dog training. So, that covers that on as far as alternative species. Their next argument is that it does not appear to be. There does not appear to be a compelling reason or high demand. And I believe that Actually, they haven't given, when I went through all their arguments, I don't think they gave a compelling reason why it shouldn't be used, excluding the fact that they don't have time, money, and personnel and stuff like that. But it's, but on the merits of actually using them, or as we're doing now anyway, they really didn't come up with anything that was concrete and why this would cause problems with native birds in the state. And I personally believe the lack of high demand for the use of California Valley quail for dog training isn't surprising, since it's illegal 9 months out of the year. And I have to explain that to people that call me, that you can't use them now. You can use them during hunting season, but that's not when you need to do training for dogs. They need to be done. It needs to be done all year on a regular basis. Otherwise, when they first go out, you only got so many months to hunt. And when you go out there and the dog's not ready, it's not good for the wild birds. The dogs don't work the way they should. And that's why I would like to have the ability to use the best quality bird all year round, especially when you consider that you're using other domestic game birds, too, to do this, but just not any domestic game quail. So this is... On their third objection was, they do not know but would likely need to investigate the potential disease animal health implications and potential genetic implications that could end up with released quail into the wild. And I'm going to read this because there's a lot in here, and I don't want to miss anything. I believe the department should be concerned about potential disease, and they address those concerns in 6, 7, 7.5 dog training and field trials. The regulations state inspection of birds. The department may inspect all birds prior to their release, and no bird may be released if the department determines that such releases may have significant potential to transmit disease to wild bird populations. For years, I've had wild quail in contact with my domestically raised quail. They hang out all around my pens. I've had to chase them out of empty pens. And it has been my experience that when I've talked to other breeders that have raised Valley quail, that that's normal, that they like to group together. And it's hard to keep the wild ones away from yours. It's just a natural. They feel safety in numbers. And if they hear the call and they see them there, they don't understand the pen. They don't understand how they're being held captive, but they still hang around with them. And I'm actually concerned about wild ones transferring disease to mine, although I don't seem to have a problem with it. It is a potential there. And as far as disease, that potential exists with all birds, and it's covered numerous times in the regulations, that they have the opportunity, or they would have the opportunity to stop any release of birds that they thought potentially could spread disease to the wild populations. It is important to realize that since domestic California quail can be used for dog training during the regular hunting season, and there is already contact between wild and domestic quail where I live and more than likely where others that raise them in the state, the concerns are the Department of Fish and Game of contact between wild and domestic California quail potentially exists now. Therefore, it should be addressed now by the Department of Fish and Game whether or not they support this regulation change. I'm not saying there is a problem, but if this proposed change to the regulations is denied, it will not relieve the Department of Fish and Game of their responsibility to address the issue that they have brought up. And I believe it's a legitimate issue. The Department of Fish and Game Commission and regulations already accommodate using domestic California quail 25% of the year during the hunting season, and I brought this up before. Unfortunately, dogs need to be trained all year round to be proficient. The last thing they say, they'd have to evaluate the economics and benefits to the public to accommodate a very limited scope and special interest. I've never been called a special interest before. I find that interesting. But now I can mention that to others. If the previously stated concerns in this memo about the risk of contact between domestically raised quail and wild quail are legitimate, and I think they are, then the Department of Fish and Game should be willing to investigate the potential implications because there is contact now. And I would like to ask the commission to please consider allowing domestically raised California Valley quail to be used for dog training all year round, as are pheasant and chucker. And I'd like to thank the commission for this time.
Thank you.
As a commissioner who dearly loves to hunt quail in the state of California, I'm having a hard time agreeing with your request for several reasons, and I've done a lot of work on this commission on behalf of dog trainers over the last few years, and helped them with their agendas. But this is one that I would be hesitant to agree with you on. I support the department's position. The California Valley Quail is our state bird. Some of the people in the department are avid hunters as well. I would venture to say maybe Sonky's not a good shot. Probably doesn't get a deer every year, but he does know Valley Quail probably as good as anybody in the state of California does. He's even authored a book on California Valley Quail, and his opinion on this particular issue I would say means as much to me as any opinion he has on anything. Anywhere that somebody who wants to hunt other than during the quail season, the state of California has the option to hunt on clubs that have pheasant, chuckers, and quail, and they all use bobwhite quail, and bobwhite quail is good in my opinion for training a dog is the chucker and pheasant, and I prefer chucker myself, but I'm just sorry I don't agree with your request, and as one commissioner I would be opposed to changing the regulation or amending them to allow people to start raising our state bird for dog training purposes.
This isn't a dialogue. You can be seated. Sonky, do you want to make some comments?
Yes, I do have a long history with California quail. I did my graduate research on them. I wrote the book on Guide to Hunting Quail in California. Longtime quail hunter. I love the bird. It is one of the finest game birds in the country, quite honestly, from my opinion. That being said, California has some of the most fantastic native game bird hunting opportunities in the world, and also because of our pheasant and chucker, some great exotics, which causes some grief for issues, as you know. The reality here is because of our concerns of moving a native bird and causing us problems with genetic issues and disease is very real. And more, as Commissioner Kellogg said, there are wonderful alternatives. This issue was debated intensely in the 40s and 50s and into the 60s on what would be the right species for dog training, etc. This was intensely debated in those days. And one of the reasons they selected particularly bobwhite, because at that point we'd already discovered we couldn't get them established here. They just don't survive. So it's a safe bird to use for training and put and take hunt programs, because we know it's not going to go native on us. And so it's a kind of a safe bird to work with. This is not the right thing to do. The department has no interest at this point even considering this. We have a lot of work to do. We would have to go through an environmental review because this is a native bird, and we would have to have the proponent formally look at the environmental impact. We just don't think it's reasonable considering the fact that we have up almost 4 months of quail hunting opportunity in the state. That's wonderful dog training. The other months of the year, you can train them on other wonderful game birds, checker, pheasants, and bobwhite quail. They're not identical, but they're suitable for dog training, and we would prefer we stick with what we've got and not mess with this one.
Any further commentary or questions from the commission? Do I have a motion?
Do you want a suggested motion?
I need a suggested motion.
I can give a suggested one from staff.
Get my glasses, sorry.
That would be helpful.
The commission approves or denies the requests of Donald Shirley and Melissa Lucas to amend Section 677, Title 14, which is to add California quail, Valley quail, to the list of species which may be used for dog training purposes. If this is approved, The commission hereby authorizes staff to publish a notice of intent to amend Section 677, Title 14.
Do I have a proposer?
No, I'll move to deny it.
Yeah, okay. I'll also move.
We actually have a move to deny. Do you second? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Mr. Shirley, are you a professional dog raiser, dog trainer?
Please come to the mic. Thank you.
I still don't understand their... I understand their concerns. What I don't understand is why they ignore them 3 months out of the year when we can use them.
You're going to have to take that up with them then. Yeah, we've already voted this down.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Next gen item.
We are going to backtrack to yesterday, item 5C, which is a law enforcement update from Chief Nancy Foley.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Nancy Foley, Law Enforcement Division. I'd asked to go last because I had hoped to be able to give you an update on some people that were watching doors and hoping to go through them on some search warrants. They're still watching the doors, haven't gone through them, so we'll give you the update next time. There were several significant cases. I think some of you have been getting our weekly reports. We have a couple of pictures from some of those cases, and pictures tell quite the story on these. If I can... I know he said the F goes forward. There we go.
It went into the abyss.
Well, let me just tell you about them while we're trying to find them. In Santa Cruz County, they were working the low tides. We had a game warden out. He saw a vehicle that looked suspicious in the area. He went down, was able to contact two people coming back up. These people had 98 black abalone. This is in the closed district. There's a chance that they were using those for commercial purposes. If you go to the next slide, you can see some of the abs on the tailgate. The method of take were screwdrivers. By the time they were able to count all of the abalone, and because of the damage to them used by the screwdrivers, they were unable to put them back into the tidal areas. So Paul Weakland's right in one respect. We still have black abalone down there that people can access. Unfortunately, they're accessing them illegally. That was one case. One of the good things about the abalone cases that we're seeing right now is those people were all taken to jail. Their cars were seized as evidence and impounded, hopefully to be forfeited to the department at a later time. We also had some dispositions on abalone cases in Sonoma and Oakland, where we got $20,000 and $40,000 fines on some abalone poachers that we got last year that were commercializing the product. So those are great dispositions that we've been able to get out of those counties. Now what we need to do is make sure that they actually pay their fines. This was a case out of Camp Pendleton down in San Diego County. We had a game warden that stopped a woman and three children. The legal limit for little neck clams is 50 each. They had almost 2,900 little neck clams. So that was about 2,700 little neck clams over the limit. Of those, close to 1,350 were under the legal size. And my guess is that some of those were probably going to end up in a market. And this is happening on a statewide basis. You know, you can go to the next slide, too. It took the wardens a long time to count close to 3,000 little neck clams. And we hope we get a disposition that we'll be able to put into a press release and publish in the papers to let people know that this is happening in their areas. Along with the ocean cases that we've had, we've also had a number of cases going on in the inland areas with the poaching of deer and elk. We've had some cases where we have, that's the last of the pictures, but we have some cases that are being investigated now where they're shooting in them and letting them lay. That's always very perplexing to me. I think the day of actually people going out and harvesting deer or elk because they don't have food has long since passed. They go out there and do this for sport now. And when
just to kill the animal. Leave it in the field.
And I can tell you, when I worked undercover, I also went out with some of these people and they took great pleasure in shooting some of these animals with a 22 in the gut and just letting them gut shoot and let them die. So it again, Mr. Hanna, it's not the hunter that we're looking at, it's the poacher, and they're two different animals. So there are plenty of significant cases happening out in the field. Our wardens are doing a great job. We started our most recent academy with 15 game wardens. One of the cadets has transferred to alcohol, beverage, and control. They make a little bit more money than we do, and they don't have the same requirements. And then we lost another one about a week and a half ago because he had an emergency appendectomy. Great kid, always wanted to be a game warden. We'll see if we can't keep him around. Other than that, we have chief's interviews for 7 additional lateral candidates that we'll be doing in about 2 weeks. These are people that are coming from other law enforcement agencies into wanting to become a game warden. We started out with 17, and we're ending up with 7 that meet our minimum criteria. Of the applicants that we had for our next warden go-around, we had only 400 applicants, and that's the lowest in our history. Out of those, I believe only about 170 have passed the first testing phase. And so from there, we'll go into backgrounds and trying to rank them, and we'll see where we end up. But I will be hopeful to get 15 people into our next academy in January out of that. That's the law enforcement update.
Nancy, with the budget cycle coming up here and imminent on us right now, is there anything that you can think of off the top of your head other than our normal activities that the commission staff might do to help with the compensation issues and, I mean, anything that we can to help the wardens?
A lot of the legislators are still asking questions about wardens' salaries and numbers, and I think it's all of our jobs to be responsive to those questions, you in your capacity as commissioners and then the department as they continue to ask those questions. I believe you might have a little bit more latitude than the department does. But
it strikes me also that some of these photographs of the poaching activities and the arrests could be really useful, talking with senators and assembly people, to show them the resource damage that is occurring simply because they have not funded enough the department with enough wardens. I mean, if we had the enforcement out there, that wouldn't happen.
I believe the Wardens Association put out a document last year. It was called the Wardens Exposé, and it was able to educate a lot of the legislators about what was happening out in the field. And it's also my understanding that the association was putting out a second expose, which will be available starting the middle of the week, although
okay,
I haven't
seen it. You've probably got a good collection of these photographs, and they're startling to an assembly person or a senator, I would think.
I believe you're right.
I would hope.
And what's more startling is the frequency in which we're able to get these pictures. Thank you.
Well said. Next agenda item.
Thank you, Nancy. That moves us to consent calendar, and I'd like to make a comment to the commissioners. Item number 21, I want to apologize for getting that draft letter to you so late in the process here. If you're not comfortable with the draft, we can table that until the next meeting if you want more time to look at that. I actually sought out assistance from the General Counsel of the Department of Fish and Game on putting this draft together.
Are there any comments from my fellow commissioner?
Commissioner
Hanna?
Yeah, the comment I would have, John, and I guess you wrote this.
This actually was written in with heavy cooperation from the General Counsel and her staff of the Department of Fish and Game, who deals with the DAs on a regular basis.
Well, that accounts for why it's way more diplomatic than I would have worded it. I think the letter ought to start out by saying, here's the problem, here's what we'd like you to do about it. This couches the whole problem in not a nebulous conversation, but in somewhat indirect words that I think could be much more forceful. We're trying to get these people's attention, and without that kind of cooperation, the wardens aren't any better off making arrests now than they were or won't be in the future than they are now. So that's my suggestion on the letter.
Okay.
I'll move the consent calendar with the exception of item 21. We'll hold it over.
Right.
There's no urgency.
I agree with Commissioner Hanna's commentary. Do I have a second on the motion? From Ms.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
So moved.
That takes us to agenda item number 24, announcement of future meetings. Next month, on April 12th and 13th, we will be in Bodega Bay. On May 3rd and 4th, we will be in San Diego. Also, let me mention in late April, on the 25th of April, we will have a mammal regulation adoption via teleconference. And then June 7th, 8th, we're in Truckee.
And if I might also, Mr. Carlson, I think we were also considering whether we were going to have a special meeting here at the end of March, which we did not identify, unfortunately, on this list.
Yeah, actually, that was directed by the commissioners yesterday, and we don't have a date for that yet, but there will be a 10-day notice posted on our website in the near future.
Any further comments or questions by the commissioners? Moved. Do I have a second on the move to adjourn? Is it time to blow Dodge? All those members, aye, aye, we're out of here. Thank you.